given specific questions at our meeting of the 17th, and we'll engage with that until 12:30, and at 12:30 the committee will spend 10 to 15 minutes just doing some housekeeping, including agreeing on our program for the remainder of this term. So we don't anticipate that the 12:30 would be a very long meeting for members of the committee. We just want to present the program, hopefully get buy-in on that, and then one or two other housekeeping issues. If that's in order, then we shall continue. Welcome to our friends from the media as well, and from the monitoring houses and so on. We also ask the department to be here, because in the next 3 weeks or so, we'll be interacting with the department on a whole host of things, including healthcare, security, and so on. So we thought it would be useful for you to sit in and also to participate once we open it up for discussion. You'd be free to participate and engage with the report or with the presentation. Could we then hand over to Just Care, introduce yourselves as you speak, and we will then engage with you at 9:30.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Please let me know if you can't hear me. My name is Cynthia Cotton. I come from Washington, D.C. in the United States this week to have some meetings in South Africa, and among those, I'm really honored and wanted to say thank you for letting Ms. Gere and I come to speak with you today. We wanted to, and just to give you a little background of who I am, I work with an organization called Just Detention International, as the chairperson just mentioned. We're an organization, a human rights organization in the United States with offices in Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles, and we focus on sexual abuse in detention. We wanted to come and speak with you today really just to present some of the observations and recommendations that we have on the issue of sexual violence in correctional centers. And it's expertise and recommendations that we think have been developed after a number of years now of working in South Africa on this issue and working collaboratively with the Department of Correctional Services. And so what we'd really like to do is, you know, over the course of the years that we've worked here, we've worked with the Department of Correctional Services, with the Judicial Inspectorate, but we've never had the opportunity to come and speak to this committee, and it seemed like it would be a very important thing to do, to just come and talk to you about the work that we've done, about some of our observations, and about how we might be able to work collaboratively, the DCS, the committee, and then our two organizations, Just Detention International and the Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation, to sort of put our heads together and think about how best to address this issue of sexual abuse in correctional centers. So my organization, just to give a little snippet of what I do and how I might be able to be helpful, is my focus is threefold. One is I work in Just Detention International's Washington, D.C. office. So my focus there is both on advocating at the national level for addressing sexual abuse in U.S. detention facilities. And statistics have shown that sexual abuse is rampant in United States detention facilities of all types, both juveniles, what we call juvenile detention centers, what you would call children centers, police lockups, prisons and jails. There's a very serious problem of sexual abuse, and we know that, statistically speaking, at least 100,000 people a year in those centers are sexually abused, and so that includes men, women, and children. And a lot of the work that my organization has done has related to something called the Prison Rape Elimination Act. And that's a piece of legislation that we worked to have passed in our Congress in 2003. So it was voted into law unanimously by both Republicans and Democrats, and then it was signed into law by President Bush back in 2003. And so that law, among other things, it called for the development of statistics so that for the first time we could begin to know something about the incidence and characteristics of sexual abuse in detention. It also called for hearings that have taken place around the country in the United States where people who know a lot about sexual abuse in detention, including inmates or former prisoners who were survivors of that type of abuse, were able to come forward and talk about their experiences and their recommendations. And really the hallmark of that legislation has been the development of standards, what are national mandatory standards addressing the prevention, detection of, response to, and ongoing monitoring of sexual abuse in detention. And so in many ways, that law has created an environment in which, for the first time, corrections officials and the community at large are really reckoning with this problem of sexual abuse in U.S. detention facilities. And it's taken quite a long time to get to that level. Right now, the standards that were developed pursuant to the Prison Rape Elimination Act are before our U.S. Attorney General, Eric Holder. So they're at his desk now awaiting review and undergoing a review process. We're hoping that they will become finalized and become law in the coming months or year. And so that's a really important step. What I'm going to do now is turn it over to Ms. Geer to talk a little bit about some of the findings that our organizations have had in the past few years of working in South Africa and you know, going into detention facilities. And as I said, working collaboratively with the DCF, we've had the opportunity to come into your facilities, talk with your officials, talk with heads of prison, or heads of center, I should say, talk with regional commissioners and area commissioners, and really think about this issue, look at it, and hear from the perspective of officials working in your centers about their day-to-day challenges. In particular, we've done trainings now where we've actually trained hundreds of corrections officials at a number of centers on sexual abuse, how to detect it, how to be more aware of it, and how to really utilize the tools that you already have in place under the regulations to the Correctional Services Act, the White Paper, the Sexual Offenses Act, how to use those things and implement them in order to address sexual abuse. So I think now what we're hoping to do is talk about, you know, today, kind of bring it all together, and then talk a little bit about a framework that we've proposed to DCS, to the head office in Pretoria, and how to move forward with that and really put in place a structured framework and set of policies that will enhance the tools that you already have so that we can really take the effort to address sexual abuse to the next level. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody, and I'm Sarah Geer from the Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation, and thank you very much for having us here today. I'm just wondering, is the PowerPoint, should I start without it, or?
Yeah, that works.
Maybe I should start my presentation without the PowerPoint, and then if our technology comes on our side, then I can reverse the PowerPoint. As I said, I work at the Center for Study of Violence and Reconciliation, our Johannesburg office. And that's an NGO that has worked broadly to prevent violence, heal its effects, and build sustainable peace through research, pilot interventions, and advocacy. And last year, we celebrated our 20th anniversary. Penal reform work has been a consistent feature of this work in a range of different ways. And our sexual violence in prison work particularly started in 2001. Initially, it took the form mainly of research. Now, I've got some publications which I'll distribute. Sorry.
We just need to point out which one is your presentation.
I've got some publications which I'll make available to you afterwards, which look at the different research we've done. We've also got a document on recommendations for the prevention of sexual violence and the promotion of sexual health in our prisons. But more recently, our work has taken the form of awareness raising and training as well. We've been involved in a range of trainings, some in collaboration with Just Detention International, with prison officials in order to raise awareness and build their capacity to deal with sexual health and sexual violence in our prisons. I'm going to launch... Okay, let me get to the slides and then I'll... Somebody arrives in a correctional center for the first time is unfamiliar with the way in which things work and the inmate culture and the levels of brutality and manipulation of work, and often are tricked into accepting something like a cigarette or protection from another inmate. Later, to discover that he's expected to pay for this with sex. And when he tries to refuse, it's made clear that there's no way out. And that's a very common part. And it's basically the vulnerability of the first-time offenders who aren't familiar with the prison context and are easily manipulated. Other things that make people vulnerable are being physically weak or not prepared to use violence, thought to have committed a city crime, to be good-looking or considered pretty and youthful, to be poor, and in our facility that consists of not getting visitors, because visitors are an important source of toiletries, money, clothing, etc. Those who don't get visitors tend to be poor and are vulnerable to exploitation. Gay and transgender inmates are often targeted, and prison rape can be a form of gay bashing as well, and the mentally disabled. But ultimately, anyone can become a victim of prison rape because of the way in which power relations and one's relationships, the power structures, can be very dynamic in the prison. In terms of what being raped means for the ongoing life of that offender, victims of sexual violence are perceived as women. Sorry, I should have said at the outset, I'm talking about this happening in men's prisons. A lot of the patterns are similar in women's prisons, but our research is focused in men's prisons. But the person who has been a victim of forced penetration...
Could you use the mic, please? Or you use
sorry. Is there a mic close by that should I not go?
So basically, once an inmate has become a victim of forced penetration, it's believed by the other inmates and often the staff as well that his manhood has been demolished. And in the words of one of our interviewees, who was a young offender, he said, "We are all criminals in here, and if I say you are a criminal, that means I respect you. But if you have had sex done to you, even the criminal in you is now gone, and you are now a woman. There is nothing we can do for you, and we don't care. When you walk past, people want to touch you or threaten to rape you." And usually, the people who've had this woman, female identity imposed on them are taken by other inmates who are regarded as men in the inmate culture, who are the perpetrators, into relationships which are often referred to as marriages. And basically, these are long-term relationships of sexual abuse. And they are supported by the gang practices and have a place in the ranks and rituals of the gangs, but they're by no means exclusive to the gangs. And also, it's by no means true that all gang members will endorse it or be involved in it. The next slide refers to this, a bit more detail about how the prison marriages operate. I'm not going to go into that now because of time, but the important point there is that because these marriages are often seen to be very similar to those happening outside prison, they're not necessarily seen, the violence in them is not necessarily close to the surface. So it's not, often it's just dismissed of, oh well, it's just a marriage like outside. And the violence in it has disappeared. So that's one thing on which we need to raise awareness amongst our inmates and staff on recognizing the violence in those relationships. Another way in which violence is legitimized is by the victim blaming that goes on. So victims are blamed for having let themselves be turned into women. That's how it's described. When clearly they don't have any choice in the matter. And again, there's another quote from one of our young offenders who said, "You can never allow a man to come on top of you if you do not like it." And just in terms of these, the definitions issue, in the survey we conducted in a juvenile institution in Gauteng, while five of our respondents admitted to having forced another inmate into having sex, 17 said that they had tricked or manipulated or threatened another inmate into having sex, which they were seeing as different to force. So there are very clear issues that need to be dealt with there around definitional challenges and what people actually view as violence. In terms of the official practices, rape is also made invisible, and a lot of this to do is with the policy vacuum around procedures for sexual violence, which confuse staff and inmates and contributes to confusion between sex and violence, which in turn contributes to the lack of recognition of victims of rape. And the way in which terms like sodomy and homosexuality are used in the correctional centre environment shows up this confusion and adds to it, where these words are used interchangeably with forced sex, which serves to muddle the issues. We need to be naming forced sex as rape and consensual sex as what it is. Also, rape has literally disappeared from DCS records in that there is no category for sexual crimes or rape of inmates to be caught in the prison records of violence. So if a rape occurs, that's taken into the record under the category of assault. And the absence of language regarding rape is mirrored in the lack of support for victims. So we see very limited capacity amongst staff who are not given the relevant skills or guidelines, and that's where we really want to assist DCS in building up these skills and guidelines. Recent training we conducted with Modibri staff was their first exposure to the issue, but it was very well received, and I think it became clear that many staff would like to be doing better on these issues, but they simply don't have the skills and frameworks to do so. And we'd certainly argue that this needs to be a part of the basic training. So while members with the best intentions are hindered by a lack of skills and clear policy to deal with sexual violence, others, as we know, are themselves directly involved in the sex trade of inmates and or taking bribes to turn a blind eye to abuses. Very quickly, central to addressing this problem is the issue of reporting. And reporting generally is not easy in the prison environment, reporting of violence. And when it comes to sexual violence, it's particularly difficult, usually because of the fear of stigma, fear of further victimization, and especially in a context where inmates can't be sure that anything is going to happen as a result of their reporting. So just one of the figures from our research was that we found that 26% of the young guys in this particular institution who'd been in prison for more than a year said that most officials won't do anything to stop it if they know about a prisoner being forced to have sex against his will. I think other influences in terms that need to be addressed in staff capacity are a sense of helplessness and resignation on the part of some staff, that sexual violence is not something they have power to do anything about, and it's rather seen as part of prison life. We've also learning from recent research that amongst staff there's an intense fear and denial and stigma of the issue of HIV and AIDS, and also homosexuality, which gets in the way of their ability to support inmates. Finally, if I may have a few more minutes, I'm just going to go through some of our key learnings. I'm summarizing those, and those are that sexual violence in correctional centers is intimately linked to sexual and gender-based violence taking place between men and women in society more generally. And this, one of the key ways in which this is because some of the most destructive ideas of what it means to be a man are endorsed in the prison environment, as are those around women, where women are seen as fundamentally inferior and slaves to the sexual and other desires of men. So as such, sexual violence in our correctional centers contributes to further violence, both in prison and when prisoners are released. And it remains unaddressed and also a subject of resignation, as I mentioned earlier. But ensuring the safety of inmates is a clear and fundamental obligation of DCS, and is also an essential starting point for the current aspirational vision of rehabilitation. It's also essential to ensure that inmates are not further brutalized in prison, which has the opposite effect of rehabilitation. Inmate safety and care should be the first priority, especially in our current context of limited resources and overcrowding. And another important point is that sexual violence is part of inmate culture and perpetrated much more widely than those who we view as sex offenders. Often there's a perception that those who are the rapists outside are the rapists inside, and it's not necessarily the case at all. It's a much wider problem than that. Also, consensual sex is taking place, but lots of violence occurs in forced relationships. Those are the marriages I was referring to, which staff and inmates may see as consensual, but which are actually coercive. And so we need to be raising awareness amongst our staff and inmates on the nature of these relationships so they can recognize them. There are also critical self-health issues that need to be addressed, and these are pertinent both to forced and consensual sex. For example, we've discovered in our research really dangerous misperceptions that lead to abusive behaviors, such as that masturbation is harmful, or that Vaseline is an effective lubricant.
And while condom access has improved, it does still seem to be far from consistent or at desirable levels. And also I think we need to look at the provision of water-based lubricants, because especially where you have perceptions like that, Vaseline can be used with condoms, we're actually shooting ourselves in the foot. There were also the issues of inmates' access to health and social services, which are as mediated through the correctional officers. We need to look at the relationships between the correctional officers and the professions and ensure that inmates are always getting the access to these services that they require. The single biggest need, which Cynthia referred to, is the need for clear policy and procedures on how to prevent and respond to sexual violence. And a note there that while our research has been focused on men's prisons, most issues are equally pertinent to women's prisons, where there is similar and great need. And we're also getting increasing reports of women inmates being abused by staff members, which is clearly an issue that needs to be addressed. Two things to bear in mind in terms of the recommendations, which are listed much more fully in some of our publications, which I'll distribute. But violence prevention strategies need to include occupying inmates with meaningful activity. Amongst other things, this provides opportunities for inmates to express a sense of personal power and respect and gain a sense of belonging. And it's alarming that the staff schedule changes seem to have resulted in inmates being locked up for longer and having less access to activities. Also, there's a great need for disciplinary options for perpetrators of sexual violence in prison, which seem to be difficult for staff to implement because there aren't enough options, and also to look at the criminal cases and why we are seeing so few convictions even when cases are reported. The final point is that our research with juveniles points to the substantial impact that prison experiences are having on their sense of themselves as men. Similarly, we found they'd gotten much of what they knew about sex from their in-prison experiences, even when they'd only served short periods. And this underscores the importance of prison experiences for inmates' development and sense of self, which makes it all the more urgent that we ensure that they are not further brutalized through their experiences inside. And that's where I'll end. Thank you very much.
So just to sort of conclude our opening remarks, I wanted to just say a note about where we are now. Now, as you know, in the past couple of years, the DCS has really been working to put this issue of sexual abuse on the agenda. In 2008, there was a day-long session that was held regarding sexual offenses and sexual abuse in DCS centers, and that was something where the commissioner and myself and someone else from my organization and Sasha Geer and other experts and officials from the department as well were present and really had a day to look at this issue. The DCS had actually prepared a sort of thematic statement about what some of the causes were and what some of its findings had been. So following that, we've continued to be in discussion, and as I mentioned before, Sasha and I have both had the opportunity to do trainings at a number of facilities to go out and talk to officials and begin to talk about what some of the challenges are on the ground and give recommendations more so on an ongoing basis to officials who in many cases have come to us and said, look, we're trying to do what we can, at least within our facility. Give us some advice, give us some inputs, and so we've been able to do that as well. More recently, though, we've been able to have discussions in Pretoria at the head office and really start to talk about how the DCS can address this comprehensively and from the top, really, with the implementation of policies and with the improvement of some of the policies that you already have in place and some of the regulations under the Correctional Services Act. So now, go going back about 5 or 6 months, we had a conversation and a actual task team was formed under the guidance of Dr. Lorinda Berg. I'm not saying her name quite correct. I think it's Berg. And so at that time, we began to really look at what we could do. And it was agreed at that meeting, at that task team, that Sasha and I should go back and prepare something, a draft framework that the department could begin to review. So we put something like that together, and it covered some of the issues that Sasha mentioned. It also just covers some of the basics, that there should be the implementation of a zero-tolerance policy on sexual abuse, an actual explicit zero-tolerance policy and approach, and that training would be provided to staff on sexual violence awareness, and that this would become part of the ongoing trainings that are already taking place, for example. And there are many more pieces of it that I could talk about, but I'll wait until we have our discussion to do that. So Sasha and I did go back and put something like that together. I've actually made it available to Ms. Bailey on the committee, and so she has it and can distribute it to anyone who actually wants to take a look at it. And then this week, Sasha and I returned to the head office, sat down again with Dr. Berg and with Mr. Hendricks, who, Stain, is he in corrections or security? Security. And really, it was exciting because we talked about the way forward. And so what's going to happen now is Mr. Stain and Dr. Berg and Sasha and I and a couple of other officials from the head office are going to continue to work together. We're going to really take a look at this policy framework that we've developed and break it down and look at how it can be applied, and then take it out to a facility and look at how it would actually work in a day-to-day setting of a correctional center, and then hopefully rework that policy framework until it makes its way up to the commissioner and the minister's office. So that's where we are now, and I think in that sense we've got quite a lot of hope that we can address this issue. And we wanted to bring this update and these developments to the committee and to all of you who are here, and to really just talk about how to move forward and what else we should be aware of and how we can make this the most successful initiative possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will, before we open it up for discussion, afford the department 5 minutes to respond if you want to respond. And I identified 5 or 4 specific areas that maybe you should talk to. The one was the last point made by the presenter. Now, this policy vacuum, is that indeed the case, that there's a policy vacuum around this matter, and what is it that you're doing about it? I think the second one that I identified is the issue about categorizing this act as assault as opposed to rape. Why is that the case, and is that the correct observation by the presenters? Most officials won't stop it. You know what our response is going to be to that, if it's true. And then the other one that for me is the most scariest of the lot. Those that are abused are abused by staff, by contractors, and by other inmates, and are encouraged by corrupt officials to do that. Those are the observations that we've been given today. We'd like you just to respond to those, and thereafter members will then raise many more. I'm just saying these are the initial ones, and then we'll get into discussion. Before we get into discussion, I'm trying to preempt us and them. If you just respond to these, then we'll open up for general discussion, very briefly.
Chairperson, thank you, and I will be very brief because I'm sure that we will engage in the discussion going forward in more detail. I appreciate the space given for this to not be an us and them, but a partnership approach to it, because that indeed has been our approach on this issue. Sasha Gere had done research in the department in 2001, which was presented to the executive management in 2002. So it's been an issue that we have been working as a partnership right the way through on this matter. I don't think that it would be correct to say that there's a policy vacuum, because that implies that there's absolutely nothing in place. There are procedures. Obviously, the amendment to the Sex Offenders Act has put us in a far more powerful policy framework than we would previously been at the time that Sasha had done her research at that point. We have got incident reporting procedures. Heads of centres have to report up their command line. They also have to ensure that there are medical procedures put in place and that there are that the reports go to the police. And in saying that, I don't want to say that we've got a perfect and complete policy vacuum, and that's precisely why the Commissioner in 2008 had convened that rape round table, anti-rape round table, precisely to be able to identify those aspects. So the process currently of that task team refining the policy framework is part of the work going forward to lift the bar. The issue of categorizing the rape as an assault and not as rape, I think this is one of the unintended consequences of trying to address a different problem, which was previously we were reporting on assault to the exclusion of rape. And what we were saying was that you cannot report on assault taking place within our centre and you do not include rape. In that process, the disaggregation of rape statistics has been blurred and has not taken place. What we are currently in the process of doing is saying that while we need to report at a national level on assault that covers all categories of assault, we have to be able to disaggregate rape, because if we can't measure it in order to be able to take decisions and monitor it and be accountable on it. So I think that's the history of where rape became included in assault, but it should not have been included to the point at which one was not able to disaggregate. So there's a process that I've initiated to correct that and get that back in place. And I think that will also enable us on an ongoing basis to monitor whether the framework that has been currently refined is in fact receiving the results that it wants. The issue of most officials won't stop it. But this is an incredibly difficult challenge. And I don't want to say that it's most, because I don't think that we've got an objective basis for being able to say that, precisely because rape is one of the most underreported crimes in society in general, worse so when you're in a prison environment and you are literally incarcerated with the very person who's been assaulting you. And I think that this is where sophisticating the framework becomes critically important, and where I think that the role, for example, of the independent prison, correctional centre visitors, and magistrates and portfolio committee members and anybody else from outside of the system becomes very important. I think that my starting point would be it does not surprise me that there is a prevalence of people, of officials, not wanting to deal with this issue, because I think that generally in society there is an issue of trying to get people to understand the real impact of the Sexual Offences Act, that rape between men indeed is rape and it's not something else. If we are having difficulty in getting people in the broader society to buy into the concept of that act, equally we will have that problem within our own facilities. We also need to acknowledge, and this is something that we'll talk to a bit later as well in the next presentation, there are processes in our department of correctional officials becoming hardened. And that's a reality that we have to deal with. And it doesn't mean that the sensitivity that one wants from correctional officials is always going to be there. Correctional officials have to balance the security mandate and the human mandate. Over time, working in a prison environment takes its own toll on its members. How do we address that? Hopefully the process currently will enable us to enrich that. A critical element, obviously, is the training. Training not only in the procedural training. Yes, if this happens, these are the steps that you're obliged to take and you're accountable for doing it. But the training on the softer issues, the training on the responsibility for ensuring human rights protection of members, of inmates within our facilities. So I acknowledge that as a major challenge that needs to be built into all of our training processes. We are currently putting a lot of energy on training, on preparing a training intervention for our heads of centres. And I think that if we can include these types of issues in that training process with a better consciousness of our training, of our heads of centres, both in terms of procedurally what needs to take place, but also in terms of how they ensure that their staff are able to manage these types of issues, that should have a cascading effect through. But I think that the training that is being done in the particular centres, and we have people here from the Western Cape who can also reflect on those elements, need to go with the training of managers. But there's a mindset shift and a cultural change that needs to take place on this issue very solidly, as it is across the entire nation. The issue of abuse by staff, contractors and inmates being encouraged by corrupt officials, I can't say it doesn't take place. There are obviously people in our facilities who need to be dealt with. For me, what would be very important is to ensure that where those things surface, they are addressed and the necessary investigations take place and those people get kicked out of the system, because that is a level of abuse of the essential element of being a correctional official, as being somebody who facilitates rehabilitation. We have major challenges as a department in relation to the organisational culture in the department, the consistency of behaviour of our officials. You can see that in some of the disciplinary hearings, that the issue that the Portfolio Committee has raised with us, and this element is obviously one element of that. So I think that apart from refining the strategy in a partnership and importantly piloting it so that we're able to check on the challenges of putting it into practice, there are a number of other initiatives that if we address them and we can integrate this into those processes, so here's the centre training, the organisational culture project, the issue of activity for inmates, all of those issues do feed into it. But I think that one of the elements that we need to understand is that to a very large extent, rape within our facilities happens at night. Obviously, it's worse the longer that you've got people locked up in cells, but it actually happens at night. So it's monitoring issues of staff during the night, where people are locked up. Your monitoring mechanisms are being able to look through windows and check in that sense. That's where people are most vulnerable. And that, I think, is where the issues of the profiling of inmates when they come in, and being able to categorise, being able to ensure that out of the current process we are able to identify immediately at the point of admission people who are vulnerable and make sure that as far as possible those people are not accommodated in situations that make them more vulnerable. Obviously the challenge there is the issues of overcrowding, but within that those are elements that need to be built into it. So I would hope that this framework that is being addressed would also feed into the correctional sentence planning process, so that we actually have that vulnerability in the same way that we have a security risk assessment, we have a vulnerability risk assessment that feeds into that process. But I think those are my initial comments. It is an issue that we are committed to. The zero tolerance approach from management side is there and has been there consistently. The challenge is obviously to get it done and to get the mindset shift of correctional officials.
Thank you, ma'am. Let's open it up for discussion. I had noted Sisa, followed by Charles, followed by Fritz, followed by Palisa. Thank you, sir.
Has that attitude of stigmatizing people who have been in prison. That's one point. Now, people who are coming out from prison, they become very bitter against society. Some of them leads, in fact, to recidivism, that is, repeat offending. Now, in prison, we say presently, a person, when he goes to prison, he graduates in crime, graduates in crime, because of the conditions he finds himself in. In fact, he becomes helpless, especially first offenders. Now, the first offenders, in particular youth. Now, the solution, therefore, will have to come in how do we control, how do we categorize people who commit crime and go to prison. Now, that's one. Now, also, there are gangsters who have the law, who are the law unto themselves in prison, the controlled prison. Now, it means now youth becomes very much vulnerable when they come to prison. Very much vulnerable. And as a result, they are forced to be women in prison, very common. When a prisoner comes, when somebody comes in prison, you know, prisoners are watching him. Looking at him as a woman, and the lady was saying, it's either they trick him. We find himself that when he comes in prison, you are supposed to have blankets, you are supposed to have a place to sleep. You see, now you have, there are no blankets for you. You are new. There is no food for you. Yeah. In fact, you are being forced to accept that now there is somebody who can give you blankets, who can give you food, can give you anything. Now, it means now you become vulnerable as a result of that. That's one problem, yeah, the priest, people in prison. Now, we are saying, therefore, that, you know, one time I made a call, I think it was in either 96 or so, when we came from Europe, we saw what was happening in other, especially the Scandinavian countries, that you must normalize a human being. Because once you separate a man from a woman, it's abnormal. Generally. That's why in the mines, you find this question of sodomy was very common. Because men were going there and they were not allowed to have their families. That was a problem. And as a result, this question of sodomy was very common amongst the men who were going there. Similar in prison, men are separated from men. From women. You know, in Britain, they were saying that there is a time when they allow visitors, that is, to stay with their partners, to come in and allow to stay with their partners on weekends, contact this and stay over the weekend. Because they are trying to, in a way, to solve this a very common problem of sodomizing these people. Never. Now, also, the problem is that in South Africa, when prisoners are locked up, you don't have warders who are going to monitor what is going on during the evening. Anything happens there in the evening. Many things happen in the evening because they are locked up, and they are locked up with gangsters. Gangsters who can only have, each one must have a gun. among these youngsters. You must have a girl among these new people, the first offenders. So that is the problem that we find now. Now, as long, therefore, as we cannot have a way of isolating, people must not learn anything about prison. That's the point, first point. They must not learn anything, because once they learn something about prison, then they become part of prison. They become part of the life of prison. So it means you separate youth, you separate first offenders totally, so that they must not learn anything from the old established habitual criminals who are in prison, who know everything about prison. So that is one of the problems that is facing us. We don't have separate prison. You know, in St. Albans prison, now they were saying that there were some comrades were there. They say, like, they encourage that there must be a separate section for people who do not want to involve themselves in gangsterism. That's the starting point. So they persuaded the warders to allow that section, so that when a person comes in as being admitted in prison, he's requested to go to that cell, so that he does not mix now with the gangsters, with those who are common prisoners. So that's one problem. But unfortunately, what they were saying, this cannot work, because ultimately these sections are limited, and now they found themselves that they have to be put in the other cells where they mix now with the other prisoners. So that was the problem, and they were trying to solve this problem. I think even here in Portsmouth, they are trying to do that, which is good, where they separate those who do not want to involve themselves with these other activities of prison. So they are put in separate cells. But these are just isolated cases, very isolated, in the 243 prisons in South Africa. Now, which is a problem. Now, not unless now this is a common approach, so that new prisoners separated, first offenders separated, youth separated when they come in. They must not learn anything about prison. That is a problem. You know, when we were at Robben Island,
they mixed us with hardened criminals, the politicians. But unfortunately for them, because we're strong, we converted. Now they felt that they have to take away those because they converted them to be, we used to call them com cream, because they were helping us. Now they're working now. So now the problem is that people graduate in crime. One problem.
Must allow
Thank you.
Mr. Self.
Yeah, I think it's time another committee.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to thank the people who presented here today. And I haven't had the opportunity of reading the report yet of the commission that flowed out of the Prison Rape Elimination Act, but I did read a review in the New York Review of Books about it, and one of the points that they made there was that this is a universal problem that can be solved, or that much of it can be solved by relatively simple management techniques. So, for example, as the National Commissioner said a minute ago, the categorization of high-risk first-time offenders is of itself an intervention that has huge effect, because if you can take out the people who are young and vulnerable, the people who look pretty, the people who are gay or transgendered, just that step alone would deal with a lot of the abuse that takes place. So I'm really hoping that in terms of the development of this framework, that we look not only at sophisticated legislative interventions, but at also, and particularly at simple management interventions, which I think would go a long way towards it. But that then underscores the importance of the staff and the people who are going to implement. It's one thing to have to say you have zero tolerance. It's another thing if zero tolerance is acted out by somebody who's on night duty, who maybe, you know, thinks that the prisoner has it coming to it. And in that respect, I mean, Johnny Steinberg's book talks about the transfer of authority from the prison establishment to the gangs. It's part of a daily ritual that takes place when the lockup takes place. Now, I mean, I think unless we address that problem, the balance of authority between the legitimate authority in the correctional centres and the gangs, I don't think we're going to get on top of this problem in any meaningful way. And which then brings me to the question of to what extent do the design of our correctional centres lend themselves to dealing with this problem systemically? I mean, to what extent can we look inside a overcrowded facility? To what extent can one live out the principles of direct supervision in many of our correctional centres, but particularly those that are relatively old, even if one wanted to? And finally, I mean, to what extent, and I think we need to really start thinking about it, do we now have to start looking at surveillance techniques? And, you know, and I understand that there might be a human rights issue involved here, but there are human rights issues involved in those people who get sodomized. And I think that if there were surveillance facilities and effective panic buttons that were acted upon, I think those steps too might go some way towards eliminating this problem. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to start off by just saying that I have absolute empathy for members of correctional service. I've just done two oversight visits this week in the Western Cape, Goodwood, and I went to Voorberg. And as Mr. Self said, when you look at just the architecture of prisons, it lends itself to the possibility of the lockup to be raped in prison. Second point is, I think I've spoken to management at both prisons or correctional centres, and have absolute understanding for the kind of attempts and small little protocols they're trying to implement. I'm encouraged by the National Commissioner saying that they're now moving to develop the standards and the protocols and taking the roundtable discussion that we had in 2008 further with the other stakeholders. I think it's so important because what I've also found on my visits now, I've deliberately in the hospital asked for the stats on the injury register. I looked at the injury register and I looked at the assaults and I asked, what of these assaults, inmate on inmate, were sexually related? And I think that's perhaps a way we can go to start perhaps specifying injury of inmate on inmate assaults to say sexual nature or physical assault by nature or some. I'm just making that point. That was very encouraging because I also look at stats. I specifically asked around rape in prison and sexually transmitted infections because I thought that perhaps one could pick up something from that. The problem is, however, that if a person on a section is not admitted to have access because you say he's been raped to the hospital section, then one won't get that kind of stat clearly. And then thirdly, the reporting issue that I think the commission also alluded to, that it seems as if, as Mr. Ben said, when people become, and specifically younger and new inmates, when they come in, they are reluctant to go report some of the things. At Goodwood, they have self, Mr. Fichler, four people are not part of gangsters. But it's power. So even if it's in that cell, power relations develop, like at a hostel, at Rondebosch High, like everywhere else, it's power relations. I think that's the point about the gender nature of sexual assault. So I'm encouraged, Mr. Chair, by the new attempt to develop those protocols and those standards and to make it national, but it can't just remain at, you know, little round tables and little coffee tables. It must go down to our, to be implemented in the on the floor at correctional centres. Thanks, Mr. Chief.
Ms. Felicia?
Thank you, Chairperson. I also want to thank the presentation. Mine, Chairperson, is about the leaders of the gangsters. I would like to know what made the gangsters so powerful in correction. Are they getting more information than the other inmates? Do they get better, let me say, blankets, food? What makes them powerful, and what make the gangsterism growing into corrections than declining? The other question I want to know is that whether these gang leaders do have money in prison, because according to our information, during the oversight visit, there is no money in prison. There is no money in cells. So what makes them having power over the other inmates? The security matter, how the National Commissioner says that if this sexual violence happens at night, right? But although it happened at night, there is tight security measure in correction. How does this happen? Is there no noise? Are the other inmates quiet about this? And the register, the complaint register, is this not reported in the complaint register? And what is the corrections department doing when there is such a complaint in the register? And I would like to know whether there is any progress or any actions that were taken of inmates having a sexual relation with other inmates, because here is always long-term relationships of sexual abuse that lead to marriage, which is a scandal for us. It's a scandal for us, and it's a scandal for our country. So really, I would like to know, were there any actions taken? Because it's clear that society is taking charge of monitoring and trying to influence policy, but nothing is happening inside our corrections of taking action. Because the actions that, the steps taken that the National Commissioner was explaining, it's not enough. Thank you, Chair.
Any other members of Parliament that would like to contribute? After that, we're going to round it up because time is against us. I note Mr. Abram. Any other MPs that would want to speak? Okay, Mr. Abram.
Chair, one takes note of whatever has been said here. I think the immediate problem is, how long are we going to allow this to take place? Are we, as of tomorrow, for example, in all prisons, going to do something? You are not going to be able to do everything. But what are we going to do as of tomorrow to at least limit the problem? These long-term plans like this strategy and this plan and that plan, we've seen so many of these things here. You know, turnaround plans, they just keep on turning around and around and around. So, Chair, the important issue here is, what are we going to do as of tomorrow? It is so that there are good people in the service, and of course, there are those that are guilty of gross wrongdoing and misdemeanors, who allow these things to happen, who are prepared to sell their souls for some financial gain or whatever. What are we going to do to snuff such people out? What are we going to do to see that there's integrity in our service, that there's integrity in the officials that are supposed in the name of the state and the people of this country to take care of the people that have been entrusted into their care? That is important, Chair. So all these other plans, yes, they may be necessary, they must come. But I would like to hear from the department, what are we going to do immediately? Because one sodomization against the will of that person, one rape against the will, naturally a rape is a rape, it's naturally against the will of a person, is one too many. We cannot allow this to happen. No matter who those people are, they are fellow human beings. We want to know, what are you going to do tomorrow? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. We are going to allow the presenters and the department to respond if they want to respond. But let us just summarize what Parliament is saying. The first thing that we are saying is that we are we are shocked, I think, by the fact that it's reconfirmed. We all know about it, it's not new. We're just shocked that it's now coming out from experts. And we'd want to, Commissioner, you coming to see us, you might not know it now, but you are coming to see us on the 12th of May around security. We'd want to know from you on the 12th of May, when you come to see us about security, what is it that you're going to do about the issues that were raised by Mr. Self and emphasized by Mr. Abrams? The things that you can do today, categorizing people as they come in, first-time offenders, and trying to find a mechanism of separating them from those that we know are hardened and are in all likelihood going to perpetuate this heinous crime that we're talking about, because it is a crime. So on the 12th, you're going to come and explain that to us. Also, maybe you should come and explain to us on the 12th, what do you anticipate the problems to be, both from the human rights activists and everybody else around improving surveillance? I think we have many challenges here. We are prepared as a committee to fight this thing about prison labor, even against whatever opposition there will be from outside. I think similarly we must be prepared to fight about surveillance, even if it means that there's going to be opposition from human rights and from everybody else, because somebody said it is also an abuse of human rights of the victim. So I think we're going to have to fight that. So come and explain to us. Not the financial implications, of course, we know that, but what type of opposition is it? Can we anticipate, and from who, so that we start engaging on this matter? I really do think we need to do that. And on the 12th, you'll come and see us about those things, and let's have a discussion around that. I think also the committee is saying that there needs to be, and we'll discuss it just now in our next engagement, there needs to be a message sent to both the inmate that is the offender, as well as the official. I heard you saying, Commissioner, that prison changes a man's mind, you become hardened, and maybe that's true. But at the same time, it can't be an excuse that because I'm a hardened somebody, that I will turn a blind eye when somebody else is being abused. And that is why we're asking the question just now, what are your disciplinary procedures in the next discussion? And I'm saying, a message has to be sent. I'd rather have a hardened person in the street, unemployed, than a hardened person as a warder. So, those are the type of things that We are saying, this is what Parliament is saying today. This is what we are saying today. And when you respond, you must either tell us that we're living in cloud cuckoo land, or you're prepared to support us, or it's a pipe dream. Because then we are able to strategize and take it forward as a committee. So those are the type of things that I thought I just would want to highlight from what has come out of members. You heard it yourself. So we'd give both the department and our presenters maybe 5 minutes or so just to begin to chart a way forward. I was trying to, in our own one, saying that, look, on the 12th, you're going to come and see us about that. And by the way, next week when you come and see us, you're going to come and explain to us, how is it that a woman ended up in a male's prison in Westville? Because this is all part of the same picture. It's all part of, if you're going to categorize young, pretty, vulnerable, whatever, boys as they're going in, you need to explain to this committee, how is it that a female ended up in a male's prison for 6 years, or whatever the time might be, or the 6 years ago. 6 years ago, but how did that happen? Because when we understand how that happened, we'd be able to see if the strategy you're talking about, ma'am, is going to prevent future ones. So when you come and see us next week, Commissioner, on the healthcare, one of the issues that you're going to discuss with us is to give us a report of what happened around that matter in Durban-Westville, and what is it that the department has done about it. We are asking that because in the minds of South Africans, there is an unanswered question as to how it happened. So we are affording you an opportunity to tell South Africans how it happened. We've heard the side of the media, journalists, reports, that is, but we've never heard the department saying, this is what really transpired, and this is what we've done about it before. We are affording you an opportunity to come and tell South Africans how did this happen on the 12th. So we are serious, ma'am. Somebody was talking about we can't talk about these things anymore. I can assure you that the Portfolio Committee is serious about this matter. The Portfolio Committee will make as much noise as possible about this matter, and we're prepared to take it to the streets if we need to, in terms of the surveillance, in terms of the prison labor, in terms of all those type of things. So let's afford you 5 minutes maybe to assist us as well in terms of a way forward. We'll ask the National Commissioner from her side, and hopefully that will become the combat dialogue for the way forward in terms of whether we're making progress.
Thank you, Chairman. First of all, I want to say, and I think I speak on behalf of Sasha as well, that we are both just deeply heartened at the response here today. And I think your words, Commissioner, and the Chairman's words and those of the members of the committee really signal to us that this is an issue that has risen to the level of a top priority for the DCS and for the Portfolio Committee, and we're just so pleased to hear that. We want to be supportive of what you are doing in whatever way that we can. So we really urge you to feel free to call upon us as you address these issues, and we're happy to provide whatever support, whatever assistance we can. I'm especially pleased to hear about your plan with respect to training for heads of center and for efforts to shift the correctional culture and also for addressing issues such as making sure that instances of rape are recorded separately and disaggregated from the other assaults that take place. And so, again, whatever support that we can provide to that, whether it's bringing in lessons learned from the work that my organization has been doing for years in the United States around these issues, as well as other countries that we work in, that's something that we would be happy to do. The other thing is I've brought some materials with me, the New York Review of Books articles that Mr. Self mentioned. I've got some copies of that and some other materials that I'm going to leave for people everyone to take. And I know Sasha brought some materials as well, but we're also happy to make sure that additional copies of those materials are available to anyone who needs them. And I think, you know, just something to underscore, and I think you made so many good points Commissioner, about the nature of sexual violence in detention, about the fact that so few cases are reported, and about the fact that what happens at night and during the lockup times at night is something that we really have to turn our attention to. And I want to underscore that I think one of the things that has been really helpful in the U.S. Sort of response to this is making a systematic effort to look at what we already know, to look at incidents of sexual abuse that take place and learn from those, and really work in a mode of corrective action. So we both have to prevent sexual abuse from happening, but then when it does happen, make sure we respond appropriately, and then make sure that we look at those incidents, whether it's looking at what role the architecture or the structure of a certain prison might have played, or what might have happened in terms of the failure to properly classify or identify an inmate who was coming in as being someone who's especially vulnerable to abuse, and then make sure that those lessons learned are considered and taken into account to keep it from happening again. And that goes to the systematic approach that, for example, if you know that sexual assaults are taking place in the shower area, for example, that you take that into consideration and then take measures to prevent that from happening again. But it also goes to your approach with respect to an individual, that once you find out, if you didn't already know, that a particular inmate is vulnerable to abuse, that a particular inmate seems to be a predator and sort of perpetrating acts of sexual abuse, that you take that into account so that that person is protected. I recall hearing about instances where, for example, an inmate who perpetrates sexual abuse might be sent for a disciplinary sanction and put in a different section of the prison, maybe by themselves for 3 weeks. And then after that 3 weeks, they're brought back to where they were before, which leaves them able to then perpetrate sexual abuse on another inmate. And that's something that we need to address. So even to the degree that there are policies in place, we need to be reviewing those policies and seeing if they're effective. And that will also help to bring the department in line with its human rights obligations, because that's really what the Convention Against Torture and other human rights instruments tell us, to look at what's happening and be in a mindset of review so that we can prevent those things from happening again in the future. And I'm most heartened about the collaborative approach that we're looking at today. I'm so glad that there's so many representatives from the department here, and especially that the commissioner is here, and I think this is really going to allow us to move forward in a partnership between the committee, the department, and civil society, as well as the inspectorate, which is another important agency in this fight, to work together and make sure that we are collaborating as we go forward. And thank you so much.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Chairperson, and I echo what has been said by Just Attention, because I think that this really is an issue that does require a major partnership. I hear the request in terms of the issues that you wanted to come back to on the 12th, and we will certainly do so. As I was listening to the questions, I was picking up that we need to afford ourselves time for a focused interaction on gangsterism, and that may well be an aspect of that security session that will enable us to deal with it. I have already indicated that immediate steps will be to start a process of tracking rape information, so that will be acted on immediately, so that we can start ensuring that while we report on assaults in an aggregated way, we're able to disaggregate it and use it. I wondered whether it would be useful for the committee before we break to just allow our delegate from the Western Cape to speak briefly on the current processes in practice, so that there is a sense of what is being done now, bearing in mind that it's not being done effectively in 241 centres, but I think that a sense from practice might actually enable us to close this off in the right way. But we will certainly be ensuring that there is a very clear message conveyed to our inmates and officials that, having presented to the Portfolio Committee on this, we have heard loudly what you had summarized as the portfolio committee, as Parliament's position on this process, that is endorsed by us fully, and that a zero tolerance approach will take place, and that there is ongoing work in a partnership which will then ensure that we use the stages of that development to also ensure that there's a sustained awareness around this issue. Because I think that that's part of our difficulty, is that from time to time we intervene on an issue like this, and it becomes something that we all become aware of, and it then gets superseded by the next issue, and we will need to find mechanisms to sustain an ongoing communication strategy around it while integrating to work as well. But if I could just give the Western Cape a moment to speak on the process.
Before the Western Cape speaks, our friends from the media normally run away before the meeting is over. Our comment is that you need to help us with educating this thing. It doesn't help that we have this discussion here, but maybe SAFM and Business Day and everybody else needs to say loudly and clearly this is what we're saying. I mean, we're all partners in this, so we really are requesting you to begin to educate that there is work being done, and it's no longer going to be, well, it's prison culture, and it must be accepted as such. It can't be prison culture and accepted as such. Western Cape?
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, members. I think I agree with all what was alluded on the table in terms of the gaps that we find in practice. But what I just want to emphasize on in terms of the practice itself, what does happen is that the rape does take place during lockup as well as during the transportation, you know, in the police vans where they're coming from the police, from the courts into our centers. And then the first encounter with us on admission, of course, it would be us to ask the offenders of are there any matters that they would like to report to us. Of course, we do know that there is bullying and the power that Mem was talking about. And then those offenders, because of the first time and the threats that have been, said to them, they will be afraid to report. But we do have structures which, depending a lot on the ITGs, because when they come, they won't be comfortable to report on us, the uniform members. They will be reporting to the ITGs, and then that matter will be taken further by our officials. But what does happen when the threat does occur in our during lockup time in our cells? The offender, most of the time, because of bullying, they will not scream or make noise, and everybody will be quiet. And during the opening in the morning, then those there might be physical bruises that you might see there, or the offender itself will report to the official. And then the first thing, we do have the rape protocol, that is a policeman. In terms of the policy procedures, we do have the rape protocol, where upon reporting, the victim will be taken to hospital, where the hospital, we have to refer the case immediately to our rape center or the district surgeon. And again, that particular perpetrator will be reported, the case, criminal case will be opened, and then justice will take that process through. But what we have done also in the Western Cape is that we're working very closely with the NPA on the anti-rape strategy, where we developed, as the Western Cape, we developed a sexual offenders program to deal with all these perpetrators. And also what we have done, we've developed a protocol of the victims of rape within our centers. And we're working with the NPA, where we've done an enormous awareness to our correctional officials, because you find that professionals themselves, social workers and psychologists, they know what to do when they are confronted, you know, with a victim or the perpetrator of sexual offenders. But we found that there is a gap in terms of our correctional officials. What is the first thing that they need to do when they are coming across with a victim of rape? So we've done the awareness in terms of, especially when there was the promulgation of the Sexual Offences Act, where there was a clear definition of rape, because we used to talk about sodomy and all those things, but rape, it was clearly defined, and then everybody knows we cannot downplay the issue of rape, or also, because the issue of them reporting that I am being raped, then that will be stigmatized, and then that will be making them less men than the others. So we brought that awareness to our officials. And I think, of course, there is a lot that we can do, but we are continuing doing that. And also NPA, they make sure that this issue of categorizing, they will say sometimes a rape and then term it as an indecent assault, and yet it was rape. So that was clearly defined, and then when the rape is rape, and then it needs to be clearly on the warrant itself that this is rape, this is not an indecent assault. So I think, Chair, that is how far we've done in the question. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and to our guests from the Center of Study on Violence and Reconciliation, as well as Just Detention International, thank you very much. I'm sure this is the beginning of a process. We'll call you, do more follow-ups. And I think the appeal made by I think it was Mr. Abraham, is that as far as is humanly possible, let this initiative not be an initiative that 5 years down the line is still an initiative. Time is of the essence to us. If you get it done and dusted, one, from a cost point of view from the department, which we're very wary about, but secondly, the benefits that will be derived once we have this thing rolled out to our center. So thank you very much for coming, and we wish you well in your projects with the department. Thank you. We'll have a 2-minute break, and then we'll move on to the department.
How are you, baby?
So that's really, but I was No,
May we start, please? Thank you very much. On the On the 17th of February, we interacted with the department, and I think it was at that meeting that it became clear that the method in which we were interacting was not being very helpful, because we just came and everybody asked all sorts of questions, and we said we want to, going forward, ask specific questions. And there were specific questions that were posed to the department. And we are hoping that the department will then respond to those questions for us. I'm sure members have seen the minutes and the responses from the department. They were very, very bulky. So if you could just talk to them for us so that we can engage. Because I think ours is to say, are we going in the right direction? Now, I'm not sure, Commissioner, how you plan doing it. Is there topics that you want to deal with and so on? And hopefully then members can just track what is being said, and if there are any gaps, we'll first ask for those gaps to be filled in terms of what we thought you would give us, and ask for responses. If there aren't any gaps, we will then engage in actually in your actual responses to us. All right. I'm hoping members have still got their minutes, or there was a thick file given to us at some point. So it's up to members just to track and see if there are any gaps. Jenny, will hand it over to you. Again, it is 10:45, and we had planned to have this engagement from 10 to 12:30. So 12:30 gives you just over an hour and 45 minutes. I'm hoping that that's sufficient time for us.
Chairperson, thank you. And I'm sure it is, although what we are also going to be doing as we go through the presentation is suggesting that there are particular topics in which we would suggest that we actually came back for a full 2 or 3 hour session. I think as I was preparing for today's meeting, part of what I realized was that there are at times instances in which an individual piece of information comes to the attention of the portfolio committee. And it's coming to us with two dimensions. The one is, what happened in this particular case? The other is, what are you doing about this as a general problem? And I think that at times, we are, between the portfolio committee and ourselves, we're getting caught between those two issues. Is this a case of, you want to know exactly what happened to the three individuals that were raised, Mr. Janssen, Mr. Lekaban, and Mr. Mbui? Or do you want to know what are we doing about discipline in relation to a particular category of types of offences? And I think that we may want, as we go forward, to be clearer between ourselves as to when we are asking for a particular report on a particular case, which at times may not be something that gets subjected to an entire portfolio committee meeting, at times because some of the issues are things that are still in a disciplinary process. Obviously, the information that is available at that point can be made available. But when are we saying, here's an incident that has raised a question around what is our strategy and our policy on that, and that's actually where the engagement would be most effective. So I thought that I should raise that just because it might help us in terms of structuring the agenda going forward. I think the other element that I wanted to put up front, because we as DCS management, need a partnership with the portfolio committee in relation to the change management challenges of implementing the white paper. And I want that to be understood not in a sense that compromises in any sense the oversight responsibilities of the portfolio committee. But as we've just seen in the discussion on rape, it's an issue that we as management have taken passionately over an extended period of time. We have started to put processes in place. We are refining it on a regular basis. But the challenges on the ground remain absolutely enormous because that's where the change management processes come through. Being able to use, for example, on that particular issue, the partnership between the Portfolio Committee, Civil Society, and the Department's management to drive that issue is very important. Part of our challenges are to be able to ensure that while we are changing policy, changing strategy, and implementing things differently, we also are able to ensure that there's a continuity of service. We need to be able at all times to ensure that by changing a policy, changing a strategy, changing a procedure, we are not making inmates more vulnerable. We are not making officials more vulnerable. We are not landing up where there's a security breach in that process. It makes the process of rolling out new strategies complex because at the one time one has to ensure that there's a degree of ongoing compliance and security. On the other hand, you're asking people to function differently. Those processes of change management also impact negatively on discipline. They impact negatively on morale. They impact on whether people have the right information. The training process of ensuring that you've got 41,500 people who've all understood that a policy has changed in this regard. Those are critical aspects that you'll see as we go through we need to consistently address. And I think that it's imperative for us to ask the portfolio committee or to reaffirm what the portfolio committee has been doing, which is reflecting back to us all of the instances in which that change management and that change of mindset is not taking place. Equally, it's an issue that our managers need to deal with, and that's a critical part of our training of heads of centres, is to ensure that they are the absolutely fundamental, pivotal people to be able to ensure that what management says in terms of policy or what Parliament says in terms of law actually gets implemented in the right way in the centre. So that, for us, has been lifted up as a very, very fundamental element of being able to ensure that what we say as DCS management, what Parliament says as the portfolio committee or as Parliament as a whole, actually sees the light of day on the ground. Okay, what we've done in terms of the presentation is to lift up per budget program, or per branch maybe, the issues that had been reflected to us on the 17th of February. and we have used both the minutes and our own notes to try and cover all of the issues. So what I would suggest is that I talk through the presentation, which will then enable us to talk through some of the detail, and I will elaborate on a couple of things, but then obviously people can follow up with issues that need to be clearer in relation to it. The first couple of slides just provided a breakdown of what we had provided to you, but I don't think that it's necessary for us to go through that process. So we will be dealing with the responses to the request. We will then identify areas that we are suggesting for special engagement that may not be adequately dealt with in the documentation that we've provided to you, and then some proposals in terms of issues that we think would be useful for ongoing engagement, some of which already correlate with the draft schedule for the portfolio committee that we have had. If one then looks at the administration program, the first element that we have provided to you is the 2003 approved organizational structure. We have had a number of questions, engagements around our post-establishment, the funding of posts, the structure of posts. So we have provided you with that 2003 structure so that you can have a real sense of the way that the department is structured at all of the different levels. I'm certainly not going to speak through that structure. I don't think that was what was being requested. But I think that what is important, we've already explained in our presentation on the strategic plan that our post-establishment is now funded at the level of 41,500. We've got 41,108 filled posts. So we have a vacancy level there that we will be attending to immediately. So the figures are cascaded there through those elements. We have already reflected that we are in the process of looking at scaling down the head office process. The OSD migration process is enabling people to migrate to centre base, which will have some impact on that. The critical element, though, that I wanted to flag strongly for the Portfolio Committee, and it is something that we will need to come back to the Portfolio Committee on at an appropriate stage, is that we have been involved in a process of looking at the alignment between structure and function. Bearing in mind that this 2003 restructuring took place in the context of, one, the public service, the resolution 7 of 2001, I think, which was the downsizing or the right-sizing of government departments, which was led by DPSA, but at the same time, our development of our white paper. So we had parallel processes taking place. To a very large extent, we did get an alignment. But what we've realized as we start implementing in practice is that there are elements in which functions have been subdivided to a point at which a coherent approach in practice is not being effectively aligned. So we have dealt with that. We've conceptualized it effectively to bring together, and I think that this is where the kind of anxiety that the Portfolio Committee has had around the emphasis that we've been putting on rehabilitation intervention will become something that we will deliver on more effectively. What we are looking at is ensuring that we pull together the development care, social reintegration, and correction program into a structural coherence. So that the management line in relation to that is far more coherent than it is. Currently, you've got development and care as a branch, and you've got corrections as a branch. The security facilities and remand detention would then be a separate branch, obviously with the process then of remand detention becoming a branch on its own, because it's actually a separate function from any correctional function. That process is currently at a stage which we are interacting with DPSA, because in terms of the requirements, there's a process in terms of structure and function and restructuring process in which consultation is needed. We were meant to have met with DPSA in the last week. Unfortunately, it had to be postponed from their side in relation to that. It's also an issue that we are going to be interacting with the labour stakeholders in a ministerial labour consultative forum, which is scheduled for the beginning of May. there are concerns that have come up from the union side in relation to some of the structural issues that we will be engaging with in relation to that. It's a complex process because not only is it redesigning structures to be appropriate for functional delivery, but it also then has to speak to your budget program. So it also is something that needs to fit into your government planning cycle. So, and I think the part of our difficulty over the last couple of years is that we've not managed those alignments correctly. So we've now taken a decision that both the budget program structure, and you'll be aware of the fact that currently we've got four budget programs that have got one sub-program, which simply doesn't make any financial sense, any sense. So we would be realigning that to speak directly to our structure and hopefully in that sense getting a better alignment between strategy and budget going forward. The principles of the 2003 restructuring were to try and ensure that we had a consistency in terms of our level of management at management area level and at regional level. Obviously at centre level we've got very small centres, we've got very big centres. And I think the Minister has spoken in her budget speech around the process of trying to rationalise those processes. But the principle that we had in that 2003 restructuring was that our area commissioners need to be placed at minimum at a director level. That is actually the level of managerial experience that one requires there. And then obviously there's a big fight that I'll pitch at chief director or deputy commissioner level. That then got us to a point of saying six regions rather than nine provinces because our centres are not geographically located logically on the current provincial basis. It does pose particular challenges in terms of the interface between regions and provincial governments. It has been managed. The regional commissioners and the DRCs have had a division of labour in relation to that, but that would be also be one of the elements that we're looking at. How do we put in place something specific for those regions so that it enables better cluster and interdepartmental involvement in those aspects? Moving from there, we then provided you with some information on the issues around the dress code discrimination and then specific cases that you've dealt with. I'm not going to speak to the specific cases, but I think that what is important is that two of them are still currently in process. What I would like to speak to as issues lying behind these issues is in fact the issues of organisational culture and discipline within the department. Because to a very large extent, if I join a department that says that I'm a blue uniform and I choose not to wear that uniform, I'm in defiance of that dress code, I'm non-compliant and I need to face the disciplinary processes. If that dress code says that I'm not allowed to have grey hair and I'm being facetious but in order to drive a point, what then do I do? Let me take an example. Our dress code currently says that you're not allowed to wear hair dyed except with natural hair colours. If I arrive at work with my hair bright pink tomorrow, is that appropriate for an organisational culture of a security service and a government department? That is a debate that we can all have, and we can talk about how far does my individual freedom go with my freedoms that are curtailed by the fact that this is a uniform service and it's a security service. But currently, that is what the dress code says. So if I arrive with pink hair tomorrow, the minister can quite easily charge me in terms of this code. I hope she would tell me first to go home and wash it or put shave it off or something. But we're in that issue. We are currently reviewing issues around our uniform and our dress code, and it is something, obviously, with issues as they come out of disciplinary processes have need to be engaged with. We've had issues around women of a particular religion who work in our facilities who want to be able to wear a headscarf. It's a cultural right that should be recognised. From our angle, we need to balance that with the security risk of a scarf that can then be used by an offender as a weapon. Not all inmates want to strangle somebody, but there may well be that person is a social worker interacting with an inmate. there may well be that we need to be able to protect that risk. So there are those types of issues that feed into the processes. So it's an issue of ensuring that while there is a policy, that policy is complied with. Where that policy is outdated, that policy is reviewed. We acknowledge that some of the policy in the corporate services environment has not been finalized as fast as it should be. In part, that was because it is an area in which some of the policy needs to be negotiated because it relates to conditions of service, whereas in other branches, it's a consultation process rather than a negotiation process. In part, there were administrative delays that were unfortunate in that respect. So for us, under the issues of discrimination and dress code, we need to be able to ensure that, one, our policy processes are finalized. We have included the policy audit, and you can get a clear sense of the fact that apart from the HR environment, to a large extent, the policy that we have identified as needing to be developed has been developed. There are a couple of policies currently en route for approval. The corporate services element is the one that we need to ensure that we are of. That process will repeal then the A order and the B order. What we recognize is that while we still have elements of the A order or the B order and new policy, there's always the potential for elements of confusion. That is a process that we are currently putting pressure on for branches to finalize those processes so that we can repeal the entire A order and B order and know that we go forward with a coherent process of policy going forward. The discipline approach, we did a major review of our disciplinary code in 2005, and it was then taken to the Departmental Bargaining Chamber in 2006, and it is endorsed by the Departmental Bargaining Chamber as Resolution 1 of 2006. I think the difference between the previous disciplinary code and this one, in the previous disciplinary code, we had a schedule of offences, of misconduct, to use the correct terminology. And in that, we had then two columns, those that were dismissible and those that were non-dismissible. Our concern was that to a very large extent it got dealt with quite mechanically. So there were circumstances that exacerbated a non-dismissible in terms of that categorization, misconduct, that really should have resulted in somebody being dismissed. But because it's in that column, people only looked at the non-dismissible sanction. And vice versa, there's one that is dismissible, but there were circumstances that would have warranted some other solution, and mechanically people got kicked out. So the approach in this disciplinary code is that there is a list of the what we've classified as misconduct, that there's an extra A to it. I could speak through that, but I'm not going to. It's a fairly long list of misconduct. What we have said is that it is the line functional manager's responsibility to determine whether and how that offence or that misconduct is addressed. Now, obviously, the first part of it is to determine whether, in fact, there was misconduct. I could well receive a report that Dr. Kutsia has conducted himself in the wrong way in relation to the way that he's been managing his petrol claims, his travel claims. Right? Now, if he's been doing that, it's either human error, or it's fraud, or it's theft. My starting point has got to be determined, did he in fact do it, or is it somebody who wants to damage his reputation? So there's an investigation process. Is that a formal investigation, or is that an informal investigation? Again, it's a managerial decision. Having got that clarity as to whether the misconduct did or did not take place, then there's a process of how serious is this element? And I want to use the medical aid fraud as a case in point, because I think that it reflects some of the challenges also that we've had in the department, because there was a period in the department in which misconduct was not being addressed in the way that it should be. And that resulted in the Joint Commission, it resulted in the anti-corruption strategy being developed, it resulted in the creation of the DIU code enforcement, and it resulted in the disciplinary code being being developed. If one looks at the medical aid code, our disciplinary code deals specifically with issues that are work-related.
Right.
Medical aid is not specifically work-related. For us, it had at that point a very particular dimension because MedCorps was a fully subsidized medical aid. So it's DCS money that is being manipulated in that process. The fraud that was committed in 1999, but it surfaces in the Jolly Commission in 2002. Right? Then, having received that report, there's a further investigation process that unearths the magnitude of it. And categorizes people as those that were involved in the organized element of that medical aid fraud, the runners, the people who were actually recruiting people to be involved in, and those who were responsible for the fraud. The stage at which those people start facing disciplinary processes is 7 years after the fraud has actually been created. At a stage at which the medical aid system has changed, and at a stage at which those people have got, in terms of their work performance, clean records. There's nothing else that has come up that indicates that they're involved in fraud. What then does one do? Does one then say, admit your guilt and refund the money, pay the money back, and you'll get a final written warning? If you don't do that, we will then take the steps and you will face the full consequences of the disciplinary code. I'm using this as an example because it reflects on some of the complexities of individual cases. The challenge is, do we have the maturity of us as managers to be able to determine, faced with this information, what is the decision that I take and how do I take it? There are also obviously time frames that are set down in the disciplinary code that one needs to comply with. At times it's easy to comply with those, at times it's not easy to comply with those. Obviously our commitment has to be, and our accountability has to be to manage them within the time frame. But effectively, the discipline issues are live functional responsibilities, except in instances of fraud, corruption, and serious maladministration, in which line functional management can refer those to the DIU, which is a centralized component in head office. Given that it's a centralized component in head office, it in itself has some implications for time frames and the use of resources. It's centralized in the national office precisely because if I'm involved in corruption, it's quite likely that I've corrupted the team of people around me. Those are the team of people who may well be used to investigate anything that is in relation to me. So it's important for us to recognize that there are those two streams. What we have identified currently and raised very strongly in our last penultimate, the second to last National Management Committee, is that the DIU needs to function very closely with line management, so there's no information gap. If I am suspended, if I'm sitting working at a centre level and I'm suspended through a DIU and code enforcement investigation, my manager needs to co-own that process. So if we don't undermine the processes of discipline being a managerial function, but at the same time we recognise that there are at times particular reasons why it needs to be taken out of line or additional resources put into it. The issues of discrimination, nepotism, there's a zero tolerance. Those are offences that are part of our disciplinary code. They are issues that should be being addressed by line management. They are issues that, if it's the line management that is involved in precisely that, there are issues that should be escalated to the DIU. We have a whistleblowing mechanism. Those are the kinds of issues that we would be expecting to have reported to the Public Service Commission hotline or to our own DIU hotline. So those issues are attended to. In a department that is as big as ours and as decentralized as ours, there is a vulnerability to abuse of managerial responsibility. It is critically important for us to monitor that carefully and be able to pick it up, and it is important that our hotline mechanisms enable us to pick up on those aspects and ensure that we put the necessary mechanisms in place. One of the other issues that we have flagged, and this feeds directly into some of the decision-making at the end of the disciplinary process. If your investigation report is not of sufficient quality, your disciplinary process is compromised. We have identified this as a risk. We have identified that there is a need for an improved training of people involved in investigations. Some of those processes have begun. Some of them are linked in particular where they relate to security investigations to the security management strategy that we will be briefing you on. But that has been in the department a major concern. In part, it's the ability of somebody to do an investigation and write a report that is defensible in a disciplinary process. In part, it is who do you appoint to investigate? If you appoint my best friend to investigate me, what likelihood do you have that you are going to get a report that really enables a disciplinary hearing that is going to dismiss me? I may well get a slap on the wrist rather than anything else. So those issues, again, are key managerial decisions, and we don't always take the right decision. But what we are increasingly saying and doing, and the regional commissioners have been quite articulate on this in our last national management, that there are particular categories of investigation that should in fact be done by people from outside of the region or from outside of a management area, obviously depending on how big the issue is. So there is an increasing process of ensuring that while you may well need somebody from that management area because people need to know the dynamics and the people of that management area, you may well want the investigation headed by somebody outside of the management area, even somebody outside of the region. So there's a greater degree of cooperation around those. For example, the investigation that I think the Minister has reported to you around around Westville involved people from the Western Cape and from the National Office. So there is that process of ensuring that we try and mitigate some of the risks attached to the way in which the investigations take place. On the seven-day establishment, I think we clarified some of that in the last meeting, that the seven-day establishment is fully implemented. We are on a seven-day establishment. There is no continuation of the old system of paying overtime for night shifts and weekends. What remains a challenge is whether the 2x12 shift system can function effectively in all centres and whether it can function effectively in all centres with the current staffing level. And I want us to have again, this is an issue for me which is a partnership issue with the portfolio committee because it's a complex issue. We have 241 centres, no two of which are identical. The staffing requirements of non-identical centres differ, and you'll remember that that's part of what the Minister was saying. If you've got a very small centre, you'll end up with more members than you've got inmates. It doesn't make sense. Or you'll end up with a one-on-one ratio. How, if you've got a one-on-one ratio, do you land up with a 2x12 shift system? So depending on your staff ratio, it becomes quite complex. In addition, we've got centres that involve farms. Your requirements of staff where you've got a farm differ from your requirements of staff if you're running a remand detention system. A 2x12 shift system in a remand detention, in a dedicated remand detention facility that starts at 6 and ends at 6 doesn't make sense because ideally in a remand detention centre you need people to start earlier in order to be able to get people ready to be going to court so the courts start functioning effectively and we don't land up where magistrates are saying we can't work our normal court hours because correctional services is bringing people late. So are we correct to say in remand detention facilities that it should be a 2x12? What are staff doing in the middle of a day in a remand detention centre? Vast chunks of those people should be, if the criminal justice system is working correctly, vast chunks of those people should be out. You've got a far lower level. Do you need maximum staff availability at that time? Do we need to design a specific shift system for remand? And that's part of the remand detention project, to be able to look at those aspects. In a situation which you've got farms, you need to be able to have people available at particular times. Does the 2x12 necessarily enable that? we also have a situation in which our staffing levels at different centres vary. We took a decision in the middle of last year to move to a point at which we lifted those with lower staffing levels up. So we can then say at least all centres are staffed at a 60% level or a 70% level increasing, rather than to land up where some are staffed at 90% and others are staffed at 40%. In a centre that is staffed at 50% and versus a 90%, to take two really extremes, the 7-day on a 2x12 shift cannot function effectively and in the same way in both of them. So we have taken a decision in January that we need to review the emphatic position that we have adopted on the 2x12 to say that where it is not feasible, management needs to determine what is feasible to enable the effective functioning of that centre. Obviously, we do need to manage the fact that there are people in the department who never wanted 7 days. There are managers who, and that's from both officials and managers. So we need to manage the change management process around it. We need to be vigilant that, and to understand fully where this is a valid staffing level problem, where this is a valid operational need problem, and where this is, I don't want to call for it. And we need to manage those processes. So ongoing monitoring of that is particularly important, and it is an issue that we've engaged with as executive management, precisely like this, that we are aware of the fact that there are elements of resistance, there are elements of staffing, there are elements of security concerns, and there are elements of operation. That process going forward will enable us to then get to a point at which, at some point, we review whether, in fact, the 2x12 is the ideal system. The critical part of the 7-day is that the shift to the 7-day establishment, along with the professionalising of correctional officials, which is the OSD and it's the career pathing into rehabilitation officers and security officers, all of that is meant to enable delivery on the white paper and the RRP. Part of what we have had to manage is, as you're asking people to shift from a particular way of working, which is a 5-day and then every second weekend, to a 7-day establishment with a different shift pattern, you're asking people to change their lifestyles. You're asking them to change the way that they relate to their families. You're asking people at times in our department to have one member of the family on this shift and another member of the family on that shift, whereas you consider as a family. Their ships pass in the night. So there are a number of different elements to it. What we are focusing on, and I think that this was articulated clearly in our interaction with you and the strategic plan, the key issue is how we're using staff effectively. The process of implementing 7-day needs, in a sense, to have gelled before we can really achieve what we want to achieve on the ORP and other issues. Because while people are unsettled around 7-day, that unsettledness goes through everything else. That's not an excuse. We have said right the way through we can't, and we said this right from when we started the Centres of Excellence project. We identified those 35 Centres of Excellence in order to be able to test a whole lot of the implementation elements of the white paper, and that has fed into the development of the ORP. But at the time that we did that, we were also saying this does not mean that Correctional Centre X, that is not a centre of excellence, can sit there and say, well, we can just continue with business as usual. So I don't want this to be interpreted as an excuse, but it's a reality of the challenges of shifting to a 7-day establishment that we need to deal with. It should be generating better time for a structured day program. It should be improving our ability to use our workshops. There are other elements that feed into that as well. We've had to clarify the issue of artisans and the issue of people, correctional officials working in the centres. Are they still able to take the inmates? There are issues around that have had to be clarified. But fundamentally, 7-day establishment, we are firmly committed to. It is in place. The shift system is being modified as we move forward. We will not back off from seven-day establishment. You cannot run correctional centers without a seven-day establishment, and you cannot deliver on the white paper without it. So I think that on the seven-day establishment is particularly important. Again, it's an issue that in the Ministerial Labour Consultative Forum in May, we will be interacting with the unions in relation to that aspect. Okay, the issue of non-compliance with the Correctional Services Act and the white paper. We have already indicated that the implementation of the white paper is a long-term strategy, that our strategic plan is systematically pulling the white paper into practice. Our challenge, obviously, is to ensure that it's consistently implemented in 241 centres and 198 community corrections offices. And we varied over the years in whether we should adopt an approach that says, and I'm trying to think of an example, a new strategy should be implemented in, if you look back at our strategic plan from 3 years ago, I think you would see it, strategy X gets implemented in 35 correctional centres, the centers of excellence in year one. In year two, it goes to another 10 or another 40, and we do it in that way. In some instances, we've said it should be done in X number of management areas in year one. In other instances, particularly where it is a legislative requirement, we have, and for example, this would be on the correctional sentence plan, we've adopted an approach of saying anybody new who comes in must go through that process. Anybody who's due for consideration of the parole board must go through that process. And then incrementally over a number of years, we will close off the backlog in that way, because that's what we're having to deal with, is a process in which we've got a backlog of people who've got old sentence plans but not new sentence plans. We have also been involved in a three-year project with the Open Society Foundation and a team of researchers from the Community Law Centre at UWC to develop a monitoring tool that will enable us to monitor the level of compliance in relation to the Correctional Services Act and around the six themes that are listed there, the conditions of incarceration, the protection of human rights, health, parole, rehabilitation, and good governance management. We were approached by the OSF. They wanted to do research on the level of compliance. We said it's one-off research is not going to help us at all. What would be far more useful would be to develop a monitoring tool that we are then able to reproduce. We've now got to the point where the research has been done, the piloting has been done in our centres of excellence. We have got to the point of almost completing the development of the electronic tool, which will enable us to pull performance information from our centres, as well as pull performance information from our centres through our existing performance information, so through our A&R system or our RDOM, but at the same time will enable us to send a team of researchers to centres to go and connect to the rest of the information. I think there's an 80-20 balance between information that comes from our systems and the 20% that comes through the interview process. So that project will enable us going forward to track for ourselves whether in fact we are complying with the Correctional Services Act and be able to identify what is it that is actually resulting in the non-compliance. It's a tool that is designed to be able to be used on a regular basis, but a regular basis, it's a major undertaking. It's not a kind of on a quarterly basis. You can track it. It actually involves a major amount of work, so it would be done, I would think, logically on probably a five-year basis, so that over an extended period of time, one is able to track those changes. It will be embedded in the department. It is not owned by anybody other than DCS. It's been developed in that partnership, so that it becomes an integral part of our monitoring system. We are currently in the process of the handover of that from OSF to the department to ensure that we have personnel within our department who've got the necessary skills to be able to do that process. Okay, then on the issue of the AG's recommendations, we've given you a presentation that gives you an update per every item of the qualifications or matters of emphasis from the the previous AG's report, the aspects that we have identified as requiring action. And that has been disseminated to all CDCs and all regional commissioners. There is a process of tracking the work on it, and I think that the version that we've given you gives you the status as of January. Obviously, at this point in time, we are currently in the auditing process. How successfully we have delivered on these action plans will be determined by what comes out in the AG's report. It is an issue that we have taken seriously as top management. It's an issue that has been on our agenda as the National Management Committee. It's an issue that we have dealt with in performance assessment processes. And we have embarked on a process this financial year, 10-11. But it relates to the way in which we are conducting the performance assessment for the year 9-10. What we have determined is that our timing of our performance assessment for senior managers has normally been in April, which is before our annual report inputs are in. It's before the management letters are in from the AG, and it's before, or it more or less coincides with when our internal audit findings coincide. The result is that I can quite easily sit down at CDC OMS in an assessment with the National Commissioner and say, I'm brilliant. This is what's in my plan. I've done everything. And I'm rating myself as a 5 on everything. Unless my supervisor has before that gone to go and collect all the information that proves that I'm lying, it becomes a very complex process. So we are adjusting our timelines of our performance assessment for the assessment to take place in July, which is within the DPSA timelines. We have to report to DPSA on completion of performance assessment by the 31st of August. Ours are going to take place in July. We are also saying that the inputs for that assessment process must be your region or your branch's submission for the annual report. So your performance for that full financial year has to be attached to that performance assessment. The executive summary of any internal audit report on your branch or your region has to be attached. National inspection report, executive summary, has to be attached. The management letter or the management report on your region or branch or on any performance audit that is done that relates to your function has to be attached to it. In that way, by building those into and ensuring that in terms of our key results areas and our CMC, we oblige ourselves to report on auditing processes, we are hoping that the seriousness with which these issues get taken will be attended to. We have also issued a circular, I think in November of last year, but towards the end of last year, but preceding the beginning of the AG's auditing processes, that was aimed to ensure that managers take the auditing processes far more seriously. We had feedback back from the AG after last year's audit that there were instances in which managers were not available for auditing processes or didn't make documentation available or made some documentation available but not others or did not engage with the draft management letters in order to be able to add value and accept criticism where criticism is due but provide answers where there in fact are answers. So we have intervened in November to ensure that the way that we as managers take auditing processes is improved. And again, in our meeting on Friday as National Management Committee, we were asking that regional commissioners and branch heads monitor that very closely during this April and May process and escalate that immediately to the acting CFO, who's the nodal point for our interaction with the AG on that. So hopefully that will improve our auditing processes. It will improve the managerial accountability around auditing processes. And with that performance assessment now taking the issue of auditing, of audit results into account, that will be taken far more seriously going forward. We have put that proposal to the audit committee of the department and they are comfortable that we should move in that direction of ensuring that the performance assessments take place after the results of those auditing reports are there so that it becomes an input into that process. But in a sense, the AG's report will give us the real indicator of to what extent we've acted effectively on those reports. On offender labour, we've provided to you a report on offender involvement in community projects per region. I'm not going to speak through it. I think it's very self-explanatory. But I do want to repeat what we said when we presented our strategic plan, that at the moment it's very varied, region to region, management area to management area. We have given you the commitment to work on a sophisticated strategy to address the issue of offender labour, and you will see it's one of the issues that we want to come back to engage with you in an in-depth session. But in saying that, I also want to commit to the portfolio committee that within our resource constraints and exploring where offender work opportunities can be provided at the expense of other departments or other agencies, and I think that Mr. Motseki has spoken on that in our session with the committee in March, we will continue to improve the existing involvement of offenders in labour, be it the production workshops, be it in agriculture, be it in community projects. But the solution, obviously, is the longer-term process. So we'll manage it both as immediate improvement as well as a longer-term process. On parole, the issues that we have given you are on the appointment processes around the parole board chair people. And I think the significant shift there is that our approach when we set up the parole boards initially was to appoint parole boards as individuals. What we are now doing, and I think it's a more appropriate interpretation of the law, is to say that what the Act actually says is that the minister must appoint a parole board that then consists of individuals, and that we are going to be appointing parole boards then for a five-year period, which will more or less coincide with the term of office of ministers, but obviously not exactly. One needs to have it slightly out of sync with that process. It's not to say that during that process one will not land up with an individual who retires, resigns, or whatever else. And obviously there will be steps in place to fill those as those vacancies arise. But we want to ensure that there's a board put in place from July 2010 through to July 2015, and that as far as possible there's continuity through those processes. One, it enables training processes. You don't land up with people coming in at different times. So we've adopted an approach of extending contracts of those who were due to expire in this period. We are in the process of filling vacancies where those vacancies have been already existent, with a view to from July being able to say, here is the parole board appointed. So where a parole board is unable to function because of a vacancy now, we will take steps immediately to fill it. Other than that, they will function with the level of staffing that they've got at the moment, and then from July there will be a full board being presented. We've also provided you with the figures in relation to the backlog. That is an issue that has been on the department's agenda consistently. It's obviously also an issue that's been taken up through the ministerial auditing task team, and that there's a process of ongoing interaction with that team so that we can address those issues. The parole summit that we had in September, and some of the portfolio committee members joined us in that process, has been translated into an action plan, and the work is delivering on that action plan. With that, obviously, is the medical parole process, which is also taking place, with some significant progress, hopefully, on that in May. The next issue that we picked up on was the issue of the transfer of offenders. And we've provided you with a report on the legislative framework. And we've also provided you with some information in relation to the reasons for transfers within the department. I think the context in which it had come up was a concern at one point from the portfolio committee that inmates were being transferred as a form of punishment or victimization, that they had whistleblown on something, and the next thing is that they are transferred. And again, without wanting to be misinterpreted, I'm not saying that that does not take place. But I am also saying that at times, a particular case may have complexities that may not be made available at the time that somebody says, I've been transferred and I'm being victimized. We in the department know of particular inmates who have to be transferred on a regular basis because of the particular way in which they conduct themselves within centers. There are a variety of different categories of when one transfers people. The fundamental principle that enables rehabilitation is that people should be kept as close as possible to where their families are, where their community is, because we rehabilitate in order to socially reintegrate in order to break the cycle of crime. And if I'm incarcerated in Guavuma and my family is living in Cape Town, how do I enable that relationship? But at the same time, there are circumstances and behaviors that mitigate against that. That is our ideal. The one element, obviously, is overcrowding. We may not be able to accommodate everybody who needs to be accommodated in that particular facility, because to do so, that would result in overcrowding at a level of 500%. I'm being extreme to make the point. We can't do that. Therefore, we need to accommodate people elsewhere. What that flags for us, though, is what is the nature of crime in that community that warrants that you need a far bigger facility in that community, and does that become part of our building plan? Right? So there's an interface between those issues that we need to take on board. At the same time, we should also be reflecting it back to the social cluster, social community development cluster, social protection and community development cluster, because something needs to be done around the reality in that community that is warranting that kind of issue. Obviously, it also relates to issues of whether those inmates are maximum, medium, or minimum. If we have a medium centre in a particular town or region, and the vast bulk of the inmates who live who come from that are maximum offenders, we then have to hold them elsewhere. Right? So there are those types of issues. We have a unique circumstance in terms of the two PPPs, in that they are the specifications that were determined at the time said maximum security inmates, so we have to be able to provide maximum security inmates to them. That has generated some concerns around people who then are transferred from other regions to address overcrowding issues in those regions into those facilities, but it then means that they're quite far from their homes. We have said that we need to ensure that there are mechanisms put in place where if you are being held too far away from where your family is able to visit you, things like facilitation of telephonic communication is addressed, but at least there is some enabling process. But it is something that is also taken into consideration in relation to people's applications for transfers. Then there are the transfers that take place because of discipline issues. Right? There are transfers also that take place because of reclassification processes. You've been in a maximum security facility. You've been in Mangaung, for example. The reclassification tool runs its course and you get classified as a medium. You therefore have to be transferred. Where can you be transferred to? Ideally, in terms of our policy, to as close as possible to your home environment. Do we have the capacity in your home environment? Yes, we do. You can go there. No, we don't. You go as close as possible to it, with a view at some stage to being able to move back. So it's a complex issue. And then there's a discipline issue. We land up where people in Mangaung go on hunger strikes and hold Mangaung employees, not DCS officials, because they're private employees, but hold them hostage. With garden implements as their weapons for an inordinate period of time. What do we do with a group of inmates who went on hunger strike around the reclassification tool, on the one hand, and on the issue of wanting to be close to their families on the other? We embark on a process of implementing the reclassification tool. Some of them are reclassified and moved. Some of them are not reclassified because the tool says this person has not changed their behavior and they remain a serious security risk and they remain a maximum security inmate. Therefore, they cannot be moved. They start off with a hunger strike. There's an intervention. Our deputy minister goes to see them. They back off from that. They then embark on further action. At a certain point in time, the impact of that group of people on that institution becomes such that one needs to take them out of that institution. You may be able to do it by putting them in a section. Right? But believe me, from having been in communication travel, even between sections in a facility, where you have an element that is disruptive to the management of a center, transfers may well be part of the solution. We have used it where we have had gang leaders who are ensuring that gangs are sustained and that gangs are involved in violent activities. We have used, and that they, obviously there are particular categories of transfers. Kokstad Imbogweni Correctional Center was designed for a specific purpose, which was really being able to deal with those inmates who are absolutely resistant to acclimatizing to being in a correctional center, to complying with the rules and regulations of a correctional center, and participating in rehabilitative efforts. So it's designed to address a number of those elements. It's single cells, it's highly monitorable. There, if you want to raise the issue of where the balance lies between surveillance and human rights, there's a case in point. But it's designed like that for a specific purpose, rehabilitative behavior modification intervention. Right? Not rehabilitation, but very serious. And there are three phases of it, and you go in there to phase one. When you've graduated from phase one, you go through those processes. You don't come out of there until you've been through those processes, because it's there to serve a particular function. You don't get sent there simply because you're genuine, you're a maximum offender, and you pitch up at Polesmore. You get sent there when you've been in Polesmore as a maximum offender, and your behavior is undermining the management of Polesmore Maximum Center, because you are proactively organizing gangs. You are involved in organizing gang attacks on members. You are there, you are involved in the issue that we've just been talking about this morning. You are involved in rape and ensuring that rape becomes embedded in the culture of that institution. At that point in time, when we have taken disciplinary steps against you in Polesmore, where we have tried to intervene, where we put you in isolation, what else then? So there are transfers that fit into those types of categories. There are also transfers in terms of witness protection. Right? I may be an offender who witnessed an attack on another inmate. That attack was between two gangs. If I remain there, I may well be the next victim. If I'm the kind of person who may well be perceived to be a witness, I may well be a victim. So move me. Move me, and trying to ensure that wherever I'm being moved to, I'm protected from whatever gangs are in that environment, because at times the communication travels with me that I'm about to blow the whistle on gangs. So there's that element of the responsibility of being able to transfer people either for witness protection or for their own safety. And I think that the point was raised earlier that if we have taken disciplinary steps against somebody for a rape in our facilities, and they are out of that section for X period of time and they move back in, the very people that they've been raped are vulnerable. So one may well then want to transfer, and it may be that you transfer the perpetrator, it may be that you transfer the victim, it may be that you transfer both. Complex managerial decisions is what I'm trying to bring out in relation to it. But I think for me what is important is for us to be able to look at individual cases where the portfolio committee hears of transfers where there is this concern. So if we're able to then say, as DCS management and to the portfolio committee satisfaction, in this instance, that transfer was in the interest of the department, the individual, human rights, or some other interest, or whatever it is, but to really be able to unpack the details of this business, it's very difficult to generalize. But I've tried to give you a sense of the kind of categories, and I've lost track completely of time, Chairperson, so I'll try to move. Okay, the control rooms. I think the concern there was whether the result of the handover of the contract for the control rooms to DCS had resulted in escape. And we want to categorically say that there are no escapes that have taken place because of that handover process. What we also, and I think that we have said this in one of the meetings. As part of that handover process, when the three-year contract came to its conclusion, there was a deliberate decision to deactivate elements of those control rooms in order to comply with warranty liabilities and in order to ensure that there was no damage to the infrastructure during that handover process. Because you'll remember that we had to train, we had to recruit officials to staff the control rooms, we had to train them. There was a particular element of it that we deliberately deactivated. Not that that never worked, it does work, but it was deliberately deactivated. We are in the process now, as we have done the training, with the necessary technology support of reactivating those processes. So I think that on the control rooms, that is, I think there's been a misconception when people have seen the turnstiles not working, that it's the white elephant. Right? It was a deliberate conscious decision, and it's a managed process. Obviously, we would have liked our timelines to have been different, and we would have liked our sequencing to be different, but that's a reality that we are currently managing. There were issues raised around the state of kitchens and ablution facilities, and that feeds into our renovation program. We've given you two slides that indicate the kitchens and the ablution facilities where we know that we've got problems. But what we've reflected there is that there is a systematic process of addressing those aspects. In relation to the ablution facilities, 3,148 have been addressed. There are another 923 being addressed going forward. In relation to the kitchens, there is money that has been put aside in this budget to address it. One of the critical elements of the kitchens is the issue of the quality and the maintenance of our cooking pots, and a number of them have reached the end of their life cycle. And I think that the processes in place in corrections branch in relation to facilities management, and in particular a renovations part of that, is important. One of the elements that I think undermined the department's work on renovations was the government decision, and this is not taking any criticism of the decision. There was a decision in 94 for a renovations and maintenance project, a ramp project that Public Works led and drove. And I think that what the unintended consequence was for us was that we put less focus on monitoring the renovations process and driving it ourselves, because that was a project that was driven very much from Public Works. So Public Works was determining what needed to be done. Those processes with our work with Public Works has changed, and the capacity has been put in place to monitor that. And Chairperson, that I think covers the issues the issue of children. We must be missing the issue of children. Okay, this element obviously relates directly to the implementation of the Child Justice Act, so it is an issue that we will hold ourselves accountable on, but we would want the portfolio committee to hold not only us but the other criminal justice departments accountable on. And it may be, I know that we have been as a team to present to the Justice Portfolio Committee, it may be that as a team at a certain point the Corrections Portfolio Committee may want to interact with us. We have given you statistics on the steady decrease of children out of our facilities. Unfortunately, because we do believe firmly, and I think this was a point that was made strongly in the budget vote speech, that children should not be in prison. But the Criminal Justice Act does enable particular categories of offenders. So whether it's a remand detainee, there has to be a considered view that child is going to be found guilty, and that guilty will lead to a prison sentence against that category of offences that are prisonable or incarcerated, that for which people can be incarcerated. We are currently in the process of auditing children in our facilities now to say to what extent do they comply with the requirements of the Child Justice Act. So we are immediately able to refer back to the courts those children to in terms of the Child Justice Act should not be in our facility. So we should be seeing the impact of that with an additional decrease in the number of children. But obviously, when we're talking about children, we're talking about under 18. We have the category of youth, which is our major concern, because children we don't believe should be with us, except for those small category of children who really committed horrendous crimes. And I think that we've already indicated that we would be aiming to get to a point where that category of children are held in a child centre. Mm. The difficulty is that in holding them in a child centre, that means that they are not necessarily as close as possible to their parents. So the support that we will be requiring from social workers, and in particular from the Department of Social Development on that, would be critically important. But to have a single under 18 child in Brunsley because they committed an offence and their family lives in that area, whereas in Polesmore you've got 15 children and you've got a social worker who is trained and equipped to deal with children, it's again, it's a balance of rights and a balance of needs. And we would need to look at those aspects. The issue of youth is one of the areas that we are saying we should come back and deal with in more detail. We have got 15 youth development centres across the country in each of the regions. Those are centres in which youth are held specifically as youth in a centre. They are very specific resources put there to deal with the requirements of youth. We do not have a situation in which all youth who are sentenced in our facility are in those youth development centres. We don't have the capacity in those 15 to match it. Part of what we need to be looking at is what is our program going forward to expand the youth development centres and to ensure that those youth development centres are addressing the kinds of concerns that the portfolio committee and in fact our youth policy address. So we're suggesting that we come back to do a full engagement on that going forward. So we are suggesting that we come back to you on offender labour for a really in-depth discussion in relation to that. That we come back to you on 7-day and the shift system so that we're able to ensure that there's a real common understanding there and you can work with us to ultimately determine what is the best possible shift system. And ultimately, is it necessary for us to have a single shift system? That's the question in my mind that is coming to the fore is, should we be determining all centres will be on this shift system? Or should we be saying, this centre needs to be on that system, that system? Okay, but there's a process in relation to that. Then on the next slide, we have lifted up issues from our priorities, because we feel that apart from the process of coming to you on quarterly reports, which we hope will sustain, because we do think that it's adding value to our accountability, but I think it also adds value to the portfolio committee's understanding of how we're tracking, so that when we come to present the annual report, it's not where does this come from? You've got a sense of where we're going and you can guide us in that sense. But what we are suggesting is that and they're not necessarily in the order that we need to do it on. But we are suggesting that we need to engage you with you on the offender rehabilitation path so that the process of ensuring that there's a common understanding of how the white paper through the offender rehabilitation path is hitting the ground over the long term, the short term to long term is there. The enhanced parole system, the legislative framework, which the timelines we've already given to you, it needs to come back to you, apart from obviously the consistent lifting up of issues that you think we need to be including in that review, but it comes back to you in the August onwards process. So we would need to brief you before it lands up where you're actually being required to take decisions on the bill. The 7-day establishment, and this perhaps links into the phase two of the OSD is the next element. The phase one of the OSD is implemented and signed, sealed, and delivered with the financial consequences that have been a very difficult element to manage. We are now moving to phase two of the OSD, which is the recognition of experience. We have this week received from the Minister of Public Service, the Ministerial Director, that determines the actual process.
we have engaged with the region prior to receiving that, to get from the region the detail of all the categories, and this is levels 2 to 7, so to enable us to get the necessary information as to what are the levels of service that people have, so that we've got a sense of where we're going to. So we now need to do the detailed calculation on the basis of the directive and move to the process of implementing it. We will be monitoring that, so we would need to reflect that back, although that would also be something that we could reflect back through the quarterly report processes. Stakeholder relations management, and I think that in a sense today's interaction gave you a sense of there have been over the years a number of stakeholder interactions, and at times the reporting back on the work done from those processes gets lost, and we think that it may be something that would be important for us to build into reporting to, because the partnerships, the chapter 3 of the white paper, insofar as it talks to corrections as a societal responsibility, is for us a very, very fundamental starting point. And it relates to what happens prior to people landing up in our facilities, but it also relates to what happens while people are in our facilities and afterwards. And that partnership for us is something that should be built not with people having relationships with the portfolio committee and others having relationships with us, but in fact a network of those relationships. And I think this morning gave us a good example of the value add that can come from looking at that aspect. The remand detention management project, we need to obviously keep you briefed in quarterly reports, but we do need to have a very dedicated discussion at a point in relation to that. We are working on the remand detention discussion document, which is in its final stages of internal consultation now. It ultimately will be a white paper on remand detention, which is a process that comes through Parliament. So we do need to ensure that we're all on the same page in relation to that. It also has implications in terms of planning, budgeting, resourcing, and organisational structure going forward. And then the last issue that we've lifted up is the issue of youth and child offenders. Those may be dealt with as two separate things, because it may be that one wants to deal specifically with the Child Justice Act and the implementation of that, and then deal with the issue of youth and crime and the rehabilitation of young offenders. Because when one looks at the age breakdown of the offenders that we have in our facilities, as a nation, it's alarming. And it may well be an issue that we want to look at, not only in terms of how are we rehabilitating the youth, but at the same time, what are the issues that we should be picking up on for the National Youth Commission, for social development, for other clusters, to be able to look at how we address what is it that is leading the youth of this country into crime, and frighteningly into violent crime, if one looks at the statistics. In conclusion, I think for us, an appreciation of the work that the Portfolio Committee has done in terms of monitoring our reporting processes on a quarterly basis, it has added value. The role that the Portfolio Committee is playing in terms of lifting up individual issues and putting them on our agenda is also a very important element of ensuring that we are consistently using all of the opportunities that we have to break the silence that can very easily happen in a prison's environment. Something that the transformation of the department has done to a very large extent if one looks back to this department 20 years ago. But there's an inherent risk that because it's inside a prison and because it's inside a secure environment, what happens there at times is not known. And that can even happen where, at a managerial level, what happens inside there is not known. So the mechanism of ensuring that we get external input is important. It also then reflects that our managers are not spending the time in the centres that they should be doing. I think that the in conclusion, our commitment to working effectively with the Portfolio Committee in terms of, one, sharing all information that you need to be able to exercise your oversight function is for us critically important. Secondly, to ensure that where you are involved in oversight and you pick up on things, that we have the mechanisms in place in the department to be able to act on them. And one of the elements for me that I think we still need to flag as a challenge is your oversight visits to centres. what we are trying to do, and I think that we do it with varying degrees of success, is to ensure that the issues that are tabled by the portfolio committee on the basis of those visits is taken back to the regional commissioner with an accountability process. We are trying to put in place the same mechanism in relation to the inspecting judge's report. Apart from his annual report, there are regular reports that he sends to the deputy minister, now given that it's her delegation, in which they have been on a oversight visit or IPVs have picked up on particular issues. But I think that from our side, there's room for us to be able to improve that element of our accountability on the perception or the issues. The observations of the curriculum, the observations that are made by the portfolio committee. Chairperson, I hope that we've got some way to doing what you expected of us, and I apologise that I've actually taken longer than you had offered.
No, thank you very much, Commissioner, because that gives us a sense from the 17th of February when we raised it through the budget and the strat planning to where we are now. I think it gives us some sort of a sense of whether we are making progress, moving in the same direction or not. I think it was a useful exercise as a refresher. I'm not sure if members want to engage, but we also just indicate to you that those that you've lifted that need in-depth discussion, I think Cindy and I will program so that we'll come back and discuss prison labor. Don't raise it now, we'll discuss it. Come back and discuss. But we will adapt our program accordingly. But if members want to just comment, we can. Let's take Ms. Paliso, Mr. Fritz, and then Mr. Fichler.
Thank you, Chairperson. No, Chairperson, one here. To thank the National Commissioner for giving clarity in some issues that we have raised and questions that we have raised during the portfolio committee time, and also giving us more insight of where we are now and where to are we going forward, and for us to go and do our homework according to our topic, to because we've got a more better understanding on clarity issues. There are issues that are clarified now. Really, we have to thank the Commissioner. There is progress, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thanks. Also, I want to concur with my colleague that I think this is a very, very detailed feedback, and I think my assertion that the Department don't take us serious, I withdraw at this point, because I'm really there. However, a few very specific questions I would ask, and this is stuff that I've picked up from my oversight visits. So if you would you allow me to ask some of those? The one question, ma'am, was there was a specific case at Haldenstrom recently about the dress code and a man who was wearing, not artificial beard, he was growing a beard. And I think he was dismissed for growing a beard, and he grew the beard for religious purposes. I just want to quickly, I don't know whether you are familiar with the case, but it was in the papers, and from my constituents it came out also just to raise the issue here at this level. Then the other question I want to ask, just clarity, it seems as if the parole board that the contract that expires now in 2010 will be extended for that. Will those be extended, or are you doing complete new recruitments around that? And then I just want to also make a comment, Mr. Chair, and I think we had, on our oversight, we had some informal discussions where we did Mangaung around the transfers to some of those areas. I think we want to say that if you feel, and this is, I'm speaking for myself now, because I know exactly what happens at Paulsmoor, when you feel like transferring people who are disruptive, specifically at that point it was Cape Town, to Kokstad. And when you see them in Kokstad, they all cry in Kokstad. And when they hear they abuse the human rights of other people, I think we will completely support you. And I'm saying for myself, we'll support those kinds of transfers. And then the last point on my last oversight visit to Voorburg, I would really, in my report to the committee and to the chair, I've asked that this committee do an oversight visit to Voorburg, medium A. I think those conditions are atrocious. I can't believe that we still have prisons like that. Correctional centers like that. It honestly reminds us of the old 1950 apartheid South Africa. And you don't, I don't blame the staff. I want to make that point very clearly. The infra, it's the kind of the physical structure of the it's called Blikkiesdorp. Complete zinc. It's hot. It's huge warehousing. 45 people to 60 people in a cell with one or two showers. I'm just like, you can't believe it still. So I'm just making, I know Bramfle was renovated, so I'm just asking, and my recommendation to the committee chair and the committee is that we actually close that prison. I know Van Rijnsdorp has also been built, but I really think that prison on that correctional center needs urgent attention. So thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Pisa,
also, I must credit Commissioner of his input. Now, you know, the question of gangsterism, you know, I remember it was being asked by a member. It's a cancer, not only in South Africa, right through the West. All prisons in the West have gangsters. Of course, the creation of gangsters was the question of the brutality that was happening in prisons, all prisons. That is a retributive type of justice that was occurring right through the world. Then they started changing, because once you brutalize people, they become brutal and they want to protect themselves. So that's how you can start to treat it in the world. Now, this question of Mangau prison, yeah? Now there is a system they are using there, which I think should be borrowed by other prisons. That, I mean, these new prisons, where you send a gangster there, and then you tell him conditions of your being kept here and getting these privileges here is that you abandon gangsterism. You know? Yeah, those are the conditions that they are allowed there. And time and again, those prisons change, because they want those facilities that are existing in the prison. So I think that is a very good idea of trying to eliminate, in a way, the gangsterism in prison now, to have these special prisons where they are, the conditions of being there is just to change yourself and forfeit. Because if you don't change, they send you back to the maximum prison, like where you come from and all that. I think that should be another way. Besides this question of transferring this to other prisons. Yeah, I think that's another way to put it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mam Nyanda.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also want to commend the Commissioner for the improvement that we raised concern, but today at least the report is giving us at least that you have done something. My concern, I was in Barberton Juvenile Center, only to find that there, the juveniles, they are wearing the very same uniform that is wear by the inmates, the elder, the entire juveniles. I was very much shocked, Chairperson. I did raise the concern that these juveniles, they don't have a right. You people, you mustn't give these people this uniform. It's not right. Because when they see the elder at that site in the prison farm, they think we are the same. So I did talk to the commissioner. The entire juvenile center, they are using the same uniform. In Barberton, in Nelspruit, my concern was that when I go there, the center is being renovated, but my problem is that the center is renovated, the contract is there, the inmates are moving around. There's no monitoring system, and it's not the center's problem. It's the contractor. Because they are saying that contractor is the second contractor. I don't know whether one of the officials is a friend to that contractor. It's a corruption, what they told me. They are having a problem with the very same contractor because it's delaying the center to be finished. This is the third month, but it's a renovation only for the leakage. As I reported last night, there was a leakage. But they are busy. The contractor is there. inmates are moving around like this. So it's not safe. They were complaining that it's not safe for them. Instead of taking the one side and finish one side and take the inmates the other side, so that this side they must renovate. It's just a mismatch. It's up and down. Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to report it in my report.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also want to thank the Commissioner 100 times. You have done well. Thanks very much. My colleagues have partly covered me. The only question that I have is I went to during my visit to Queenstown. No, I know that I'm going to report it to the committee, but I want to know that. We talked a lot, Chairperson, about the offenders who have given bail, but there were lots and lots of juveniles who have from 100 rand bail to 500 rand. Mm-hmm. They were there more than 7 months. Mm-hmm. They don't have bail, but I've got a list of them. It is in Queenstown Prison. Otherwise, Commissioner, you have done well today. You've opened my eyes. I was walking in the darkness of the night. Now the sun is shining. You have cleared my road. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just to, and I'm sure you're aware of it, Commissioner, and I think it's a very good practice which we will continue. When we went on recess, we asked every member to go and do oversight as close to their constituency as possible. And you can hear comments coming out of it. We will get reports ourselves, and depending on the report, we will forward it to you. But I think it's very important because it gives you the real hands-on experiences. So this is what members are talking about when they say I was here and there and there. But I also was at CMAX. I just wanted to raise one issue at CMAX, because you raised it as well, the RAMP or revamp program. Now, I think this is going to have to be a broader discussion at the ministerial level. You know, the old gallows, if you want to call it the gallow area, when I spoke to the head of CMAX, he indicated that the department was looking at revamping it and making it offices or whatever else. It is currently just an empty space. However, indications are that the political... the liberation movement, as well as I think it's the Heritage Center, are wanting to have that center re-established and made a museum. So I'm just saying that if you're renovating it and you're thinking of getting rid of it and these guys are thinking of that, we might want to have a discussion as to how we have it. That was just the one area I picked up there. The second one, in CMAX, and I thought it was an important one, and they were very wary of raising it because it might even border on gender insensitivity, and I'm raising it here as well, also in the same vein. You know, the management was saying that there are, in their view, maybe too many female. Remember, it's a males-only center, and it's maximum, and they have a high number of female warders that they can't really use, one for the safety of the females, because this is just a terrible area. But they, I think, are struggling to be able to raise it at your level or any other level because they fear that if they raise it, they'll be accused of gender insensitivity. But I saw their point because, I mean, I was scared when I walked in that area, and I don't know how we'd have females doing a effective job there. And I just said I would raise it at some point. So those are just the two. And again, my report will also highlight all the others. But we will give you, from time to time, a comprehensive report of everything that came up from members, just those that we think you need to attend to. Others that are not for your attention, we will share amongst ourselves. But I think we'll pull out areas of, and today you've got examples of some of the areas. Let's take Mr. Fischler, and then you can just wrap up, ma'am.
I think I agree with you, Chairperson, on this next piece. You know, when I we went there one time, I even asked the warder, the male warder, how do you manage to move around this? The people who were serving 1,000 years, 500 years, 7 lives, 8 lives, they are dangerous. They are walking in, you know, in at least they are lions, you know, they're moving. They exercise. I said, no, man, it's too dangerous. He said to us, no. If you do not give a person hope that one day he will come out, you don't give him some privileges, then he becomes more dangerous.
Mm.
No, that's what I was saying. So I agree with you that for women, I'm telling you, when we were even frightened, we couldn't move around that town. Yeah, because they are certainly wrong. I mean, to them, they can kill you because a person who saved 7 lives is going to die in prison.
Mm.
They have given one time, 2,000 years.
Mm.
He can kill you. He won't. You know, he knows he's going to die in prison.
It's just
to respond to those things. Chairperson, a couple of responses, and others we will take up. I don't want to respond on issues that may be part of disciplinary processes, but I'm not sure exactly what the status of them is. But I think for me, it will really add value to this department if the oversight function that our Act gives to this portfolio committee is taken seriously, and if those reports are made available to us. Our Act quite deliberately gives you access to our centres in order to ensure that there is a mechanism for somebody from outside of centres
mm-hmm.
to come in and observe us. And we put it there for a very specific purpose, and it needs to be used effectively. So we will welcome those reports, and we would hope that we not only get the reports where there are problems, but we do get some of the reports that say this is a centre that is actually... Because part of it is morale boosting as well, to be able to feed back in. I did also want to just pick up on the issue of the specific things, the issues I'm not going to respond to, but we will take them up both immediately and as you send through formal reports on it. But I did want to pick up on the issue of the issue of women, because I find it interesting that people at CMAX are hesitant to raise it, because in fact it's an issue that we at executive management level have raised. And it's an issue that we really do need to push through to its logical conclusion. CMAX is a particular environment, but even in a maximum security environment, not everybody who's got 3-4 life sentences is in CMAX. A whole lot of them are in our ordinary maximum security facilities. The CMAX ones are those that have got real extreme behavior problems. And yes, I can sympathize. It's a horrendous environment to walk in for 2 hours, let alone to work in all day. I mean, I sit here as a gender activist, but I do not believe that we are correct in saying that we should be aiming for equity for men and women in a male maximum security environment, let alone in a CMAX environment. And it's a policy issue that we need to engage with, and it's a policy issue that we will need to be able to engage with the portfolio committee, so we're able to say, here's a constitution that enshrines equity. Here is a reality of the security and the risk environment, and how then do we find those two? And what do we do with Jenny, who as a correctional official wants to work in CMAX? And I'm not using that can't be an argument for saying we shouldn't address the issue. But there are women who choose to work in that environment. Right? How then do we... It has serious staff utilization implications, because if I'm a woman working in a male environment, I have to be with a male member. That's what our policy says, and it's correct. But it means that instead of saying, here's a group of inmates and here's one woman, here's one official who can guard them, there now need to be two of us. Right? If you've got limited staff, you're wasting staff utilization. What does that then mean? That we are taking women out of the rehabilitation environment and out of the security environment? Because if you look at our balance between women and men in terms of inmates, we've got 4,500 women. Well, we've got far too many women officials to look after them. What is the role that women should be playing with children, for example? What is the role that women should be playing in youth development centres? Should we not be saying, let's utilise our women's staff more appropriately to places where they're able to add value precisely because they're women, because there are differences between them, you know, and there is something unique that women can bring into a rehabilitation environment that will be a value add. We have women who choose to be in our emergency support team, and they do their jobs extremely effectively and extremely well. And one doesn't want to land up in a situation which one says no woman can ever be part of an emergency support team. But at the same time, there needs to be a process in which the risks attached to taking that as your career choice are upfront and known before you go into it. It does involve different training. Do we train the women who work in maximum facilities to be able to defend themselves? That is one of the interventions that we have looked at. But I think that would be an area of engagement that it would be very useful for the portfolio committee to engage with us on. But apart from that, thank you for the positive feedback. I think that it's something that I'm really glad as we close off the 19 financial year that we're able to have a clear sense of what it is, what your expectations are as a portfolio committee of us. And obviously going forward with a new national commissioner in the near future, we will ensure that the process of interacting with you continues and that we share the lessons that we've learned over this past time. And I think that we've got a better sense now of what it is that we need to provide to you. And at times, I think part of what we've been doing is providing written documentation but not then talking it through. And I think that may be one of the gaps that we want to ensure going forward. That while we provide you with the details that you've got it, we actually then talk at a high level to it rather than assuming that because we've given it to you in writing, that's enough of the process. Because sometimes it's in the talking that one talks on the managerial challenges that we experience. And that's where, as managers in this department, the partnership with the portfolio committee becomes very important. Where we are not doing what we should be doing, we should be subject to severe criticism. But at the same time, the reality of the challenges that we're experiencing, we need as much of a partnership as possible in dealing with it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Commissioner. Can I indulge on members? We're not going to be more than 10 minutes, I think. But the department can pack up and leave, it's fine. I just want members, I'm not sure if members have this in their pack, that they have the second term program.
Yeah.
I just want to refer to the second term program, please. We don't have any minutes, do we? No, but I'm saying that for today. That's good. All right. One, we just want members to at least in principle agree to it, but in light of the issues raised by the department, where we might want one-on-one, we'll change it again, but at least this will be the framework of what it is. Safe to say that next week, the 21st, can members just add that we're going to ask the department to come and give us a report back on that female detained in the male center at Westville? Okay. So the 21st will have that item added to it. The department are coming to see us on health, but we'll ask them to give us a briefing on that incident in Westville. So that's the one change. And then the week thereafter, we were going to meet the department on parole boards, chairpersons, and those things that commissioner has already spoken about. But we're also asking the minister to come and brief us on the escapes in Westville, as well as where we are with the National Commissioner. You remember we deferred that engagement last time. So on the 5th of May, I beg your pardon, 5th of May we'll be interacting with the Minister on the report from Westville Escapes and on the Commissioner. And if you turn the page, on the 17th to the 21st, on our oversight visit, We've sent a request to the powers that be for us to be able to do a visit to Limpopo private facility, Rustenburg, Coxford, and Durban Westville for a week. However, we've prioritized Limpopo. So if they came back to us and said to us, you can only have one day, it's Limpopo. You can only have 2 days, it'll be Limpopo and Rustenburg. If you can have a week, it'll be all four of them. Okay, so that is subject to approval. But we prioritize Limpopo with all our affairs. And then minutes, we will probably, as we go on, there are no minutes today, but we will, I'm sure there's two sets of minutes, including today, that we would have to adopt. Can we then go ahead and concretize this program? Committee is happy with that?
Yes.
All right, we will include with Cindy some of those that the commissioner has picked up. So if there's a gap where there's maybe just one item, we might put prison labor and ask them to come and see us and that type of thing. Thank you very much. Our meeting then is adjourned until Wednesday next week in S35 at 9 o'clock. I know we said 9. Do we need the whole 9 o'clock? I know members normally complain about the 9 o'clock meeting. Is it going to be the same? Well, we've derived it from 9 o'clock anyway. Okay.
Chair, the new program can send me then.
Yes, we will update it. And then, but it's going to be a living document. What we will do is we'll update it with the agreement of today's meeting. And as we come back, we'll then update it with whatever we think we're going to pull out from Jenny, and then whether it's labor, whether it's whatever. So we can get that to them. So we can do that. Yeah. Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am. Jenny and them gone. Can you call her for 1 minute, please? This one. So you need leave, no? Oh, sorry. You know, we were having this big debate about service level agreement between yourself and public works, and then the budget of those things that we took us. Where's that thing? Because we don't have it in our program. Do we need it? Because we need to put pressure. Can we put it back on our program? Okay. Okay, thanks. Okay. All right. I don't know, she was with us yesterday. I didn't see it today. Yeah, Cindy, we must put that thing back as soon as. In the morning. Capital. And then from there? Where? It's probably going to be West. No, we'll get there.
Okay.
We'll get there, yeah. That's yours, yeah. So what you asking for leave for when? Oh, from tomorrow you'll be born. Okay. Let's leave from tomorrow on.
Yeah.
No, that's good. All right. My time. I know we've got a sitting now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, 2 o'clock. And we've got a sitting and then we've got a budget on home affairs.
Yeah.
Tomorrow.